gone insane. An upside-down civilization cannot be real. A world of madness and terror.
It's the Dana Gould Hour.
It's springtime
for Hitler and Germany.
Welcome to the Dana Gould Hour podcast. We have a terrific show for you this month. The host of TV Guidance Counselor, the great Ken Reed, is here, all the way from Boston, Massachusetts. And real-life Forrest Gump, star of the Animal Planet's Emergency Room Vets, and former bouncer for some of the greatest rock and roll bands in the history of music, the man of a thousand careers, the man Keith Richards made go to medical school, Kevin Fitzgerald, is here. As for me, we're busy, busy, busy here at Falcon's Lair Recording, gearing up to film season 3 of Stand Against Evil and some other projects that can't be announced yet, but I'll be sure to let you know when they're ready. If you are in the Austin, Texas area, I will be at the Moon Tower Comedy and Oddity Fest in late April. I think April 22nd to 24th. Come on by and see me. You can check out comedymoontower.com. comedymoontower.com for details. So check it out, why don't you? And now, let's do our filthy business.
It's showtime.
It is a sort of a perfect Sunday afternoon. A little chilly. Mm-hmm. I mean, California chilly.
Yeah.
Not chili chili.
California chili comes with pineapples in it.
Right, exactly. Yeah. The great Mamas and Papas song, California chili.
Yep.
And it's a Sunday afternoon. It's a little overcast, but not too much. It's a little cold, but not too much.
Slight breeze.
Slight breeze coming in off the ocean. And I'm here with Boston's own Ken Reed.
This is the sound of my voice.
Of TV Guidance Counselor fame, but so much more. And I had a whole, and just to show you, you and your lovely girlfriend, Rachel, have been out here for how long now?
2 weeks.
2 weeks. And just to show you how comfortable I am with you, how at ease I am in your presence, you've been here in my home for, what, 4 minutes?
About four.
Yeah. And I completely let rip a tuba-esque belch.
It was a belch. It was booger-esque.
Right in front of your wife.
Yeah.
She was like, oh, I'm sorry, Rachel.
To be fair, she requested it.
I'm many, 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 many months into my relationship with the lovely Barbara, and I'm still on a fart hold on that one.
Oh, yeah. Fart hold is at least to 12 months.
Yeah, yeah.
Fart hold has to be longer than it takes to gestate a child.
That's true. That's
yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
I was on a production or something or whatever it was, and a guy was with this girl, and they're working together or whatever, and at one point he just said, we're never going to fuck, are we? And the woman went, no. And he went, good. Brack.
Maybe he thought that was going to turn the tide.
No, that's just like, good, because yeah. I really have to fart.
Yeah. I've been in pain for 4 months.
Emma Arnold and I are very close, mm-hmm. in a very fraternal way, in a non-sexual way. But I still don't think I fart around Emma.
That's just politeness.
I guess so. Yeah. Is that what it's called?
I think so.
Let me write that word. Yeah. How do you spell that word? Polite?
I think it's like P-O-L-E-L-I-G-H-T.
George Carlin had a great bit, the first guy who farted. The air is coming out of me.
Well, actually, I had I did this as a bit on my album, but we had a kid in high school who farted and shit himself in the hallway. And And the bit I talk about is I found out he died, and that was the only thing I remembered about him. And I was like, that's why I do comedy, so that no one will be like, remember the time? So he farted and it smelled really bad. And then this kid goes, Brad, just shit yourself. And he just went, a little. So it's always just like, that's his legacy, is a little.
There's a story. It can't be true. Guy is in a restaurant, doesn't feel well, goes into the bathroom, doesn't get his pants down. Like, he gets his pants down, not yet to his knees.
Yeah.
And everything goes against the back of the toilet.
Yeah.
And the smell is so overwhelming because it's not covered by the water.
Yeah. And it's also not normal poo.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The smell is so. So many people are turning off this podcast. I'm not going to listen to this episode. Yeah. Then he immediately vomits straight down into his pants.
Nice.
That are like perfectly below.
Yeah.
like a bowl.
It's like a dream catcher.
Like wedding to catch. I don't know if it's true, but I want to watch it. But the whole thing has to be in like under 5 seconds.
Yeah.
It has to be like, bang, boom.
Oh, it's on video?
No, but I mean, that would be the great way to have it happen.
Yeah.
If it did happen, it would have to be that quick for it to be funny.
Well, there's one of my favorite.
Otherwise, it's tragedy.
Oh, yes. If it was like over a 19-minute period, there's like moments where it's just quiet and him going,
yeah.
Oh, no.
And you keep cutting back to his terrified kids wandering around the restaurant. Where's our dad?
Papa. There's a. One of my favorite YouTube accounts is called News Be Funny, and just every month they like compile news bloopers, which are comedy gold.
Oh, yeah.
But there's so many weathermen farting. And one of them's this French guy, and he's like pointing out, and then you just hear a huge fart, and then he goes, oh, pardon. It's just like, you acknowledged it.
Have you ever seen the weatherman that has to walk off?
Which one?
No, weatherman with diarrhea. And
oh, yes. Goes, yes.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. One of my other favorites is this. They clearly have time to kill.
And my heart bleeds for that guy.
Oh, yeah. Like, it's terrible. Oh, yeah. I'm so sorry. And he's just like making a call.
I'm also like, this could be the end of my career.
Yep.
All right. Yeah.
But do I stand out here and then just hope no one notices?
Definitely end my career.
Yeah. There's one where like they clearly have gone early and they need to kill like a minute and they're having that awful crosstalk that anchors have. They like, hey, it's Wednesday. And then the news lady goes, Wednesday, yep, hump day. And then she goes to the weatherman. She goes, let's hope it's a dry hump. And then, the weatherman and the other anchor go, oh. And then it's just like 30 seconds of quiet. It's great.
My favorite one. Did you ever hear the one about it's sort of an older woman, very somber, like, she looks like a Latina Margaret Thatcher.
Okay.
And she's like, and we will be right back after this. And then she thinks she's off. And she goes, what the fuck are you doing? And then they have to come back. I have to apologize to everyone.
So sorry for that. There's one more.
But you can just tell like right away, like, oh, she's an asshole.
Yeah. Oh, many of them are.
You can tell in a second.
There's that Bill O'Reilly one.
Yeah.
Because he was a Boston anchor.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And everybody hated him, rightfully so.
Yeah.
And, Mother Alive.
Yeah,
Mother Alive.
There's hours of footage like that from Boston. That's the only one that's leaked out. But when I worked at Channel 4 in Boston, they had like compilation tapes they had made. That
just Bill throwing a hissy fit.
Him freaking out. Yeah. Which I'm surprised haven't managed to leak out yet because they're fantastic. One that always makes me laugh is there's a guy talking about the debt. Somebody died. And he goes, he was 72 degrees. And then he goes, which is funny enough anyway. And then later he goes, correction, earlier story, he was 72 degrees. And just says it again. It's perfect.
Did you ever see the news? This is not funny, but I'm going to laugh at it. The woman that's doing a remote and she's having a stroke.
Oh, yes.
That's so I have seen horrifying.
That yes.
That's everybody's nightmare. They're just going to be like, now I'll tell Ken, what do you think about L.A.?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm like, are you I didn't know that you love the gods must be crazy that much.
That would be the Serling-esque comeuppance of Trump.
Yeah.
That he cannot articulate.
Well, he basically can't.
Yeah.
Actually, I was telling you, before we started recording, Ministry has a new song that sounds like 80s Ministry. It sounds like Killing Joke.
That's
fantastic.
Amazing.
But it's all about Trump, and it's called The Twilight Zone, and it starts off with Make America, him, all these Trump samples, and they have the one where he's slurring, so he's like, Make America.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's
fantastic, yeah.
But he'll live into his 90s.
Yes, both his parents did.
Somebody said, guys like that don't get heart attacks, they give them.
Yeah. I'm such a bad person that when he got elected, I immediately looked up how old his parents were when they died.
Yeah.
I was like, damn it.
No, he's going to live a long, long time.
Well,
I'm just like, I'm so cynical. I'm like, I think if everything comes out, if all of the worst things that everybody imagines all come out irrefutably true, I still think the people go like, but he still should be president for life.
Yeah. Well, he's like, white.
Okay. Yeah. Those president for life. Yeah. Okay.
It's like if you know someone
Nothing surprised me.
No. And if you know someone who's a huge asshole to everybody, but like you grew up with them, you'll be like, well, he never did it to me.
On the day he resigned, Nixon had a 24% approval rating.
Yeah.
He had said for 2 years, I didn't do it. I didn't do it. I didn't do it. I didn't do it. These people are full of shit. They're full of shit. Okay, I did it.
Goodbye.
And then people are like, you're still great.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look at G. Gordon Liddy. That guy killed people.
Yeah.
Like, he straight up murdered people. And he was a guest star on TV shows in the 80s. He was on like Miami Vice.
Yeah, no.
And The Equalizer.
G. Gordon Liddy, the guy Nixon said was crazy.
Yeah.
They were like, you hear it on the tape. They got this guy Liddy. Apparently, he's a goddamn lunatic.
Yeah, he's going too far.
Yeah, he really wants to go to jail for us. Great!
Yeah. He was like poisoning people and was all about clandestine murders.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're like, hey, this guy, he's got a cool mustache. His voice is all right. Let's put him on The Equalizer.
He was called, a healthy right-wing exuberant.
Yeah. Yeah. It's insane.
Yeah. It's just madness. But we were talking about this the other day, like as you talk about, because you and I both, we work a lot, but we don't work in a office environment where we have to, you know, I can listen to the radio when I work.
Right.
I can, you know,
can't completely shut the world out when you're working.
I'm not forced to,
yes,
you know, but the question is like, how much of the world do you let seep into your head during the day?
I can't.
And how much do you react to it?
Oh, I react all day. Like, I can't block it out because I'm like, what happened in the 10 minutes that I wasn't paying attention? And I was never like that. Before the last year, I don't think I ever watched MSNBC or really ever watched CNN, unless, you know, there was some breaking Bronco chase type thing. And now it's like, first thing, TV goes on first thing in the morning. Check my phone first thing in the morning. It's always there. Like, I have real trouble even like watching a movie. It's not as bad now. You're like, oh, I got 2 hours of my phone off, which is insane. And it's not like I'm going to do anything.
You just turn your phone back on and the first thing you see is the White House with a hammer and sickle flag flying above it. Wow, what happened? Yeah. It's only been 2 hours.
Well, I always think, do you remember the miniseries America from 88 with Chris Christopherson?
No.
It was a two-part ABC miniseries where there's a bloodless coup of the United States by the Soviet Union. Uh-huh. And that's the opening of it.
Is he the appointed president?
He's like a senator who's like, this is bullshit.
Oh, I
he's
see,
the hero. And then it ends up with the Senate finally gets some balls, and then the Russians just come and kill them all.
I was gonna say, that's how you know it's fiction.
It's science fiction, yeah. But it's eerily similar. I keep seeing parallels. Like one night I was like, I'm just going to relax and watch a dumb movie. There was a double feature of RoboCop and The Running Man on. And I love both those movies.
Uh-huh.
And I watched it like almost in tears because I was like, it's not a parody anymore. And it was like, this ruined this for me.
That's really true.
Or I was watching
either one. It's a beautiful day here high atop the Mulholland Drive view shelf here in sunny Southern California. Of all of the interviews that I've done on this podcast, you know, the great thing about doing this podcast is you get to meet people and you know, and what I always find fascinating, my favorite thing is when you're talking to somebody you know, or you think you know, and you start talking to them and you realize you know nothing about them, or you know, the tip of the iceberg of their life. Everybody has a story. Everybody's life is fascinating, but some clearly more so than others. My guest today was without a doubt the finest example of that in my life and my favorite interview from all of last season. We are speaking via computer. He is in the beautiful state of Colorado, and I'm joined by Dr. Kevin Fitzgerald. How are you, Kevin?
It's nice to hear your voice.
I only saw you. Was it 3 weeks ago? 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, 2 weeks ago, yeah.
And now people might remember you from last year. You, although you are now a known What veterinarian or veterinary?
I'm a veterinarian.
You're a veterinarian. But you're kind of a famous veterinarian. You had a show on Animal Planet. You have a couple.
Yeah, we had a show on Animal Planet for 11 years. You know, a couple, we had a couple of them. And,
just
and
11. Just 11 years.
But it was a reality show. It was one of the first ones. We did it from 97 to 2008. And, you know, what they would do is they would come and just follow the cases through the emergency room. It was called Emergency Vets. And so they had a camera right on you, and it wasn't scripted, or you didn't get another take, and we didn't stage anything. And so it was what you saw is what you got. And it was an interesting thing because, you know, oftentimes if I told you, I'm going to ask you about the direction of stand-up comedy, what you think is going to happen, and I'm going to come back in 5 minutes, and I gave you time to kind of put something together in your mind, get some nice sound bites. But here they'd say, these C-sections, how many times do you have to, you know, they'd ask you something, and then you'd watch a thing later, and you go, of all the things I could have said, or your fly was down, or it was an interesting thing.
They said
they'd be like they would be like a fly on the wall, and they really were.
Amazing. You're in an emergency room, do you get a lot of things like a dog, like, hey, there's a light bulb in my butt, but I don't know how it got there. Yeah, sure.
Well, the things that dogs eat, I did a special show for Animal Planet called Things Pets Swallow. And it was 35 years of what we've cut out of dog stomachs. And so I think...
Can we have some of the greatest hits? And by the way, if you walked into a room and go, I have an idea for a show, it's called Things Pets Swallow. Yes. Like that's a no-brainer.
The thing that they bit on when we went after that show... I was gone after a show using Betty White interviewing famous people with their pets.
I'm glad it wasn't a show called What Betty White Swallows.
she's the nicest.
She's famously lovely. Something horrible.
You can't, because when I was opening for the Morris Animal Foundation doing these fundraisers for these different animal charities that needed money, and she's lovely.
Yeah.
And so I was flying to the first show, and I said, now, Miss White, I'm going to be totally clean. She goes, What do you mean, be totally clean? She goes, I've been in show business my whole life. She goes, you're not going to say anything that shocks me. She goes, Golden Girls was four old broads sitting around doing dick jokes.
Yeah, I'm sure that the onset chatter at Golden Girls was as bad as anything you'd ever heard.
Yeah, like you said, she was lovely. She was lovely.
So what are some of the things you're doing the show called Things Dogs Swallow?
They like underwear a lot. They'll eat a thong, and the embarrassing thing is oftentimes it's not the wife's thong, and so we've had several of those. Or often they want the thong back, and so it's been through his intestinal tract. What do they cost? $1.50? I mean, I don't know how much women's underwear cost, but I'm sure there's different gradations of it. But holy cow. So you're always surprised. But the thing about being a veterinarian is you're pleasantly surprised, because people often will do anything for their animal.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about a thong, but yesterday I noticed my oldest daughter's bra was out back. And I said the dog had just gotten into the laundry and found the bra. I'll play with this.
Yeah, what's this thing? Yeah. No, being like where you are now in California, here since 2014, marijuana has been legal. And so we see 1 to 2 marijuana dogs a day that eat the edibles or the cookies, eat the brownies.
Now, I know very little about, they predicted that if marijuana was legal, that you would immediately slide into a apocalyptic dystopia. Has that happened?
Hasn't happened here. In fact, I think that they're able to generate a lot of funding for parks and for infrastructure and for education for the schools.
Well, it is one of those things. It's just one of those common sense things. Like you here's something you never hear. You never, ever, ever, ever hear this. You know, Ted's a great guy, but when he's stoned, what an asshole.
Yes, that's right. You don't hear that.
Yeah.
So
what if we did more
with my culture with being Irish? I mean, alcoholism is kind of like Irish cancer. I mean, it's so prevalent. And there are guys like that where you just go, hey, don't invite Patty. Let's let him, you know, he can't come to the christening.
Well, yeah, coming from a very similar background. There's an expression called the lake took him.
And I've never heard that.
Somebody drowned in booze. What happened to Patty? Oh, the lake took him.
And boy, it really says it all.
Yeah, it really does.
It says it all.
But you were telling me, now, you have this fascinating life where, and we'll get into this later, but where before you became, Keith Richards was the person who helped steer you towards your career as a veterinarian. And that's a true statement that we can just leave there.
we can say that.
That'll take us down. That's a true statement, basically.
It's true.
So we'll get into that. But you were just telling me that, were you in Mongolia?
The Denver Zoo bought 187,000 acres in Mongolia in 1994 and gave it back to the Mongolians as their first national park. So Mongolia was run, it was Russian. The Russians threw the Chinese out in 1922. And Mongolia was the second communist country. And the Russians used it as a buffer between them and China. Mm-hmm. And it's a gorgeous country. Genghis Khan coming out of these plains on these little shaggy ponies and getting all the way to Poland and, into Baghdad and conquered China and India. At one time, the biggest landmass, biggest empire of any country. And so it's a gorgeous place. The Russians kept it under their thumb and wouldn't let Westerners in. And so in 1992, the Russians left. And the dean of the vet school told me, he said, we woke up on a Sunday and they were gone. And they were losing money in the war in Afghanistan and losing so much money with Cuba. And so they just gave up.
Important lesson right there. As they say in Afghanistan is where empires go to be destroyed.
That's right. The Brits were there. The Romans gave up. Alexander the Great was there for 3 years and then finally said, okay, we won, and had a big party. And his generals said, wait a minute, we didn't win. And he killed the generals. And said, oh, yeah, we conquered and we're done.
Yeah.
And so, it's an amazing place and it's a gorgeous place. Wow. I'd love you to take you there with me.
I was watching an episode of Growing Pains, of all things. And that's normally an easy go-to, where I'm like...
Now, do you watch Growing Pains because you watched Growing Pains as a kid and it soothes you?
Yeah, I think it does. Although I feel like the second and third season are actually really well written. Like they mm-hmm. There's some funny, weird fourth wall breaking stuff in there. This particular episode was not one of those.
Growing Pains was starring
Alan Thicke.
Right. Got it. Okay.
Joanna Kearns. Right. But there's an episode
who apparently was really funny.
Yeah.
He worked on Fernwood Tonight.
Yeah. He was a writer and he wrote theme songs. He wrote Different Strokes and the Facts of Life theme.
Yeah. He was a writer on Fernwood Tonight. I saw his name in the credits. I was like, what?
That's why they gave him Thick of the Night and it was terribly unfunny. Mm-hmm. It was one of the worst talk shows I've ever seen. But,
supposedly a great guy.
Yeah. I had been emailing with him to be on my show mm-hmm. the week that he died.
Oh, that's
there's sad. Like a list of people that's happened with and it's always bums me out.
Well, I famously killed Jim Henson.
Yes. Yes, you gave him strep throat in a makeout session.
I know
really?
The guy. I was with him 3 nights before he died, and I do know the guy that supposedly gave him the flu that killed him. And I will tell you that gentleman's name off the air.
Okay. why were you hanging out with Jim Henson?
I did his last project. It was a pilot called Handmade Video, and it was me and Jordan Brady and Sean Masterson.
Okay.
And a bunch of other people. And that I didn't know this. I found out later that Judd was originally going to be one of the guys, Judd Apatow, and Jim didn't think he was like telegenic or whatever.
Oh, really?
And Judd goes like, this is the guy that taught me the alphabet.
Yeah, and he goes, you just don't have
kicking
it,
kicking me off a show.
I can make a rug sample telegenic, and I've decided you're unsalvageable.
Yeah. You'd have to hear Judd tell the story to get it right. I hope I'm not misrepresenting what he said, but I didn't know that he had he was involved in that.
He had axed it.
Yeah, but I literally had dinner with him at his house. The next day I went to New York, and the day after that, or the following day, I was in my manager's office, and I really didn't want to do this pilot. It just, I was like, ugh, please don't let this get picked up. And my manager said, hey, that's too bad about Jim. And I go, well, what are you talking about? He goes, Jim Henson, he died. And I went, oh, I wish. Just because I thought he was kidding.
Yeah.
He knew how much I didn't want to do the pilot.
Right.
And he was like, no, Dana, he died.
Yeah. You're like, I have good news and bad news. I don't know which you think will be what.
Right. But
since he died, the Muppets have been Van Hagar. It's just not the same. It's just been like a cover band Muppets.
Timothy Dalton Muppets.
Yeah. It's not even because it's just like every time I watch it, I'm like, oh, this is people who really liked the Muppets not doing the Muppets. It just isn't the same.
You know, Brian Henson, he's like, he's your dad. So you can't argue with him about what he was. But I think there's just something like with Walt Disney, and it's like Walt Disney was who Jim wanted to be.
Yeah.
There is something about this particular individual that is greater than the sum of its parts. And,
yeah.
And it just kind of metastasizes out into whatever they're creating.
Well, he also had that sort of fuck you hippiness.
Absolutely.
That was, you know, the sort of usable side of the Manson clan.
Yeah, I would say like the flip side of, you know, the coin would be Jim Henson on one side and Terry Gilliam on the other.
Yeah, where it was like,
who you no longer are allowed to say
his name. Can't say his name anymore. But it's that.
Like, I still like him.
I still like Terry Gilliam, but he's just a crazy old man. And he always has been.
Everyone become. Yes, he always has been. Yeah. Anybody who is shocked that Terry Gilliam has said something offensive to their sensibilities has no idea who Terry Gilliam is.
When he made Baron Munchausen, the studio decided that was a kid's movie. I don't know if you remember this. And so they had Terry Gilliam do the rounds on like kids' shows to promote it. And Nickelodeon had a show at the time called Don't Just Sit There. That was a show hosted by kids, which was kind of a fun show, but it was like tween MTV.
Yeah.
And he was on, and he goes on, and he doesn't want to be there, but he starts telling these kids how he wears women's underwear. And just like, it's like deadpan, like, oh, really? And these kids don't, I felt so bad for the kids, but even as a kid, I was like, no, he's just fucking with these kids.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, that's who he always has been. He's like, whatever.
When he made Brazil and the studio wasn't going to release it, there are many, 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 many ways to go about dealing with that situation. He did the show business equivalent of standing on a chair in the middle of a dinner party and calling someone at the table an asshole.
Yeah. Yeah. That's not going to work out for you.
Yeah. He did the least subtle. He took out a full page ad in Variety and Hollywood Reporter, called out the head of Universal Studios by name.
Yep.
It was like this, you know, you don't want this to resolve the way you want it to do.
He's not going to go, oh, you know what? You're right.
You know, Terry. You have a point.
You got a real point here, and you can have your way.
Yeah. So please don't be surprised that Terry Gilliam.
No. But Henson, I always was like, he had that sort of hippie ideal that was still like, you know what's keeping us from having this? You fucking assholes. It was a really weird sort of subgenre of that nobody else that I can think of sort of carried on.
Yeah. And Jim Henson was like that towards the establishment, and Walt Disney was like that towards the other establishment. The establishment of the people who ran the studios in Hollywood in the late 40s and early 50s.
He might have just liked Volkswagens.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure.
I always...
But that's true. I mean, he was just like, you're not going to take this from me.
No. And I tried to do a character once, and this may be the dumbest character idea I ever thought of, which is saying something. And it was a rapper who was obsessed with Roy Disney getting screwed over by Michael Eisner, who was just like, yo, Roy Disney's the heir, man. Roy Disney got fucked. And it's just like, I have no idea why I thought this was funny. But it's this guy who was like violently angry about Roy Disney getting screwed over with the Disney company.
Somebody I know tweeted this, and I can't remember who tweeted it. So my apologies to whoever tweeted it. It was not me. It's not my joke.
Okay.
And I'm murdering the joke.
Okay.
Might have been Allie Ward. Might have been. I'm not sure. But it was, if a Tesla gets stolen, do you call it an Edison? It's like, wow.
Yeah. Fair enough.
You went way.
Guy was a thief.
You went way down on that one.
Yeah. Yeah. My dad installed that in me earlier where he was like, Tesla got screwed, man.
Yeah, totally.
My dad was also like, thinks he invented time travel and all kinds of crazy things as well. He's way ahead of his time. He was in touch with aliens.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure, I know aliens.
Yeah.
Sure, I know a couple of aliens. Yeah, like, who has the heart of, like, did Tesla, you just wake up every day like, Al Gore. And I'm not saying he got robbed. I mean, what happened happened.
Yeah.
It was a fluke. I'm not even saying that you stole it from him. It was just this fucked up thing happened with the ballots and he got fucked. And you just go, yeah, Nixon. And you know, Nixon, there's a very good argument that Richard Nixon won the election in 1960.
Yeah.
And then a lot of dead people in Illinois voted.
In true Kennedy fashion.
True Kennedy. Yeah. And then what do you do? Like, but back in those days, you took it for the team.
Yeah, you'd go, that's what happened. Next time, it'll be in my favor.
Right.
Or something like that. Yeah.
And then you take it too far and you get Watergate. But like in 1960, you didn't go like, hey, I got robbed.
There's cheating going on here.
You're just like, Marcus of Queens. They still have Marcus of Queensbury rules, as they say.
Yeah, there was some level of gentlemanness or like some we're following the
and
rules.
People say that is gone. I don't believe that's gone. I believe it comes instantly back to a degree, because I think that it takes Trump doesn't behave in the way that he behaves because he pre-calculated this algorithm. He's
an idiot.
He has a he has a personality disorder.
Yeah.
And is not capable of shame.
Yeah.
And
people encourage it.
Yeah. And he's a professional wrestler. Yeah. And it's just like, he does it because he can't not do it. Not because he thinks, oh, I'll really. And in the one debate where before the debate, he was just with all of the women that accused Bill Clinton.
Yes.
I mean, that was one of those things like when the Joker took away all the hairspray and
no makeup.
Like, like, how can you do that? You can't. Well, you don't do that.
Well, the timeline.
That's not what you do.
The timeline recently is even better because while he did that, was when Michael Cohen was actively negotiating the Stormy Daniels thing, like that day.
Newt Gingrich was having an affair the day he impeached Bill Clinton for having an affair.
Yeah, his wife who didn't have cancer at the time.
It's all brilliant. They're all reptiles. And I was trying to think, like, if you were running against, like, if you were running, somebody is going to run against them. Do you just laugh at him, ignore him, or... I would get like the greatest Fred Trump lookalike.
Yeah.
And seat him next to Stormy Daniels or a Stormy Daniels lookalike and just have them kind of fondle each other during the debate. Like there's going to be some good deep dish crazy thing.
Your plan to defeat Trump is cribbed from Friday the 13th, part 4, the final chapter. You're going to dress up like Jason's mother, but basically dress up like Fred Trump and go, Donnie, you've been a bad boy.
Also a little bit of psycho, too.
A little bit of psycho.
Psycho, too.
Yeah. But I think that I feel like Trump's more like Jason in that he's developmentally disabled and just brutish. But I thought, I mean, every single debate, I was like, oh, he got his ass kicked. Everyone was like, you won that one because he's like, no puppet, you're puppet. I'm like, wait, he's not even speaking. Like, he's like, I don't need articles.
But what I'm saying is I don't think that it's people go, there's no more normal than I think it goes back.
You think because it's just an aberration?
It's an aberration because of people. It's like Andrew Jackson was crazy. And I think people behave differently because by and large, people behave. And
people don't want chaos.
Some people do. I mean, people do. You know, on Twitter and stuff, a lot of people, the people that you engage with that aren't bots.
Yeah.
And many of the people, if you are tweeting and somebody disagrees with you in a way that seems almost cartoonish.
Yeah.
And if you go to their profile and there's nothing on that profile that's specific to an individual.
Yeah.
It's fake.
Or especially if their handle ends in a series of numbers.
Yeah. It's just like if it's a picture from a movie and memes. Their ID. Yeah. Yep. And their character and their thumbnail is a guy from a it's fake.
Yeah. Which is reverse image lookup is wonderful because you can do reverse image lookup on Google and it'll tell you what a photo's from. I don't know if you've ever done that. So so those people you like reverse image look up their profile photo and it'll tell you like, that's from this movie. Like, that's a photo of this guy.
Right. Yeah. If it's not somebody that's clearly a person, if it seems very, you know, it's not a person, but a lot of the people that are real, they say like, I'm really glad that he's stirring things up.
He's still your president.
Yeah. Oh, just like, I like that he mixes stuff up. Yeah. I like that that's good for a week.
Yeah.
Some things you don't need. Yeah. I'm going to release some pandas in the middle of your surgery.
Yeah.
Just to keep mix it up.
Just make it a little different. Well, yeah, if you tell them, like, all right, down at the plant where you make, I don't know what you make, let's get a new boss in there who just sometimes comes in and slaps you.
Yeah.
Or just comes in and is like, everyone has tomorrow off, unpaid.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, wait, what? Like, he's mixing it up.
We're going to give this family of baboons nail guns.
Yes.
And you're all going to go into a haunted house maze.
Yep.
Just mix it up.
It's boxing glove day at the plant, everybody.
Yeah. You were talking about this of your this idea that you had to take comedians to these places that you travel to, like that, and just to expose
Antarctica, and to take famous comics with me on expeditions,
or me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would totally do it, and it is amazing it's really important, and we had this conversation that you're a citizen of the world first, and that would expand your opinion of things. And just to go to these places and see these other places, it must be so mind blowing, like, to be in Mongolia, different people's different cultures, and that you're one of many.
We get tunnel vision, you know. Yeah. We get tunnel vision, and it is a big world. You know, there's 10 million other forms of life on the planet besides us, and I think that, you know,
we all love America.
We were given this wonderful intellect and this great biodiversity, you know, so all the other animals are waiting for us to use our intellect to save the place.
Uh-huh. Now, that's what you're talking about. Three schools of thought. There's one that I guess it would be more Eastern, that we are the custodians of the planet, and that the planet is our home, and it's our job to take care of it and to nurture it and to preserve it and to... and that would be, I would think that would be your attitude.
Well, future generations aren't going to thank us for, you know, sitting by. Imagine, you know, you with your daughters, if the only time they'll be able to see ever see a polar bear is in a book, you know, or you get a headline before we check out that says last polar bear died today, and I think that we have a, when an animal becomes extinct, the world becomes a less interesting place. And although most people never get to see these things, I think it's reassuring to know that they're there, and that these things are in you know, where they should be, in place. And
there is a natural rhythm in the macro sense of that species do become extinct. But so a lot of people will look at that and go, if it's extinct, it's extinct. The brontosaurus is extinct. That's how it goes. But people understand that we are, because of what we are doing and human expansion into the planet, it's accelerated by thousands, a rate of, you know, multiple thousands of times faster than it should be taking
place. Right. The extinction rate right now is 100 times what it was before there were people. And by the end of this century, it may go to 1,000 times.
Let's say frogs become extinct. Oh, the better example, bees, where there's all these weird diseases that are ravaging the bee population.
Yeah, I've got 10 hives here at the house. And it's peaceful for me. I'm a bachelor, and you just go out there and you take care of your bees and smoke them and take care of them. And it's interesting to see.
I don't know what. Slow down. First of all, you're a bachelor, but you've got the built-in, as we call it, the closer. Would you like to come to my place and be covered in bees? So right out of the gate. Have you ever seen a naked man in a beard of bees?
That thing's always on Facebook. But, you know,
what do you mean by smoke your bees?
Well, they get grumpy when I go in and clean them up and you know, give them their vitamins. And so by using smoke, they become sleepy. They're kind of drugged, and I can do what I need to do. But
what do you mean by give them their vitamins? I'm just imagining you with the world's smallest needle. I can't find a vein.
They feed themselves but I supplement them with a little bit of food, and there's vitamins in it. Uh-huh. And so just to keep them stronger, and they're so interesting, Dana. You know, when I watch my bees, you know, one will come in with a heavy load and five
other
bees.
Take a lot on his mind.
Yeah, no, and five or six others will come. So everybody's useful. There's no slackers. There's no bee slackers.
And now, but Emma Arnold also raises bees. I have a lot of friends who raise bees. But the point is, like, let's say the bee population gets decimated. That's not just the bee population is decimated. That has an effect all the way up the food chain. Everything has an effect. It's as if one of the things in climate change was a lot of people go, so it's 3 degrees hotter. Who cares? No, 3 degrees hotter globally results in this, you know,
right,
you know, this city disappears.
We take so many things for granted. But if the bees disappeared, we wouldn't necessarily totally disappear. But I think it within 3 or 4 generations would be in a world of hurt.
You were telling me something that is an interesting, where you really have to be careful about your source of information. I think you were telling me this, and it was about a year ago that Rush Limbaugh said there are actually more polar bears now than there were 200 years ago. Completely false.
Well, you hear this stuff all the time, and yeah. like maybe everybody says now, you know, people are entitled to their own opinions, but not their own facts.
Yeah. And there's the other one. There's more forest land in the United States now than there was during the time of Lewis and Clark. No, that demonstrably false.
Yeah, look at Kansas and Iowa. They didn't look like that, you know, with all those. We thought that our world was infinite, and it's not.
And that leads to the other school of thought that is very prevalent and strange to me. But there's a very Western religious belief that the earth was given to man by God, and we are to use it up. And then when we're done using it, God will come. And we get a ride someplace else. And that's a common belief.
I don't believe in God, but I'm still afraid of him. You know, I was raised Catholic, but people say, oh, what can I do? I'm just one person. But it turns out quite a lot. And so I think we can't be pessimistic. We have to be optimistic and figure this out. And we have in the past always figured things out. And I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic because I go to schools and children get it. I think the best thing people can do is to take a kid to the zoo or give a kid a pair of binoculars and get him outside. And you know, not to maybe make him a veterinarian or a biologist, but make him a naturalist, even though, you know.
Just make him curious.
Yeah, and so I think there's so much we could do with you know, just as an individual that you can do, and it's a minute to midnight. We still have time to do something.
I believe it was my friend Joe Rossetti who may be listening. Hi, Joe.
Does he have something called the Rossetti Stone?
He is from Massachusetts, and he lives on the Cape of the Cod.
Yep.
And he's a very popular morning DJ down there.
Oh, okay. That Cape. Yeah.
And we grew up together.
And his show should be called the Rossetti Stone.
It very well may be. But I think he said if the world didn't end in 1968, it's not going to end.
Yeah.
With like RFK and MLK and Vietnam and the Prague Spring and all of that.
I love their first album.
And other new romantic bands.
Yes.
But I think this is on par with that. It really is, where things are happening at a point that you can't keep up with them.
Absolutely.
And the one thing that the early 70s was that we will have to go through in the future is the hangover.
Yeah.
There will be an economic
crisis,
hangover,
yeah,
and a cultural hangover.
Yeah.
People will just be exhausted,
and we'll get another rollerball
something.
But yeah, it's the thing that I didn't live through the time, so it's hard to get a complete gauge on it, but I can remember it dimly. Yes, the two things that disturb me the most are the tide turner in the Vietnam War was them showing actual footage of it, and no one had seen unedited, unpropagandized war footage.
Right.
And people were like, what the fuck is this? And that really shifted the public against it, which now you don't have anymore,
right?
Because it's hard to shock people with images. And also people are untrusting of images.
Yeah, they don't.
It's on the news that someone just CG'd it or whatever it is. I think even if we got a Trump sex tape, they'd be like, that's not a real tape. And he would say it's not a real tape. You know,
I think if he said it was a real tape and people knew it was a real tape, it still wouldn't
care. Yeah. But he has that plausible deniability, which you didn't have.
Yeah.
And a weird thing I've noticed among younger people is although we grew up loving dystopian science fiction and Last Man on Earth type stuff.
Yeah.
The key word
being fiction.
Yeah. And there is some amount, especially when you're younger, there's some amount of wish fulfillment with it. Yeah, like Dawn of the Dead. You're like, I got a whole mall just to me. But it seems to have gotten so much worse and I don't know if this is because people look at things in almost a video game way, like with stuff like The Walking Dead, where they're like, it'll be great if this happens. They don't seem to have the gravity. Like, I just remember being horribly terrified of global thermonuclear war at any time. And I wasn't kind of like, it'll probably be kind of cool. Something cool might happen. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, there's.
No, I mean, anybody who lived, anybody that was, as most of the people listening to this podcast, was alive and aware on 9/11.
Yeah.
It wasn't cool.
No.
it was shocking.
Yeah. Because you.
And it was so disturbing when the president came on and said, things are back to normal. Just go shopping.
Yeah. And no, it isn't. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's those,
buy a necklace.
Yeah. That says never forget.
Yeah.
It's the thing where you have no historical parallel or personal experience to link to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't even go, even if it's a bad thing where you go, this happened once and it ended really bad, but I knew what happened. You don't have that. So you're just like, I don't know what is going to happen next.
Yeah. Yeah. We're angling into my latest bugaboo. And we talked about this the other night. 3 points. One, the video game thing.
Yeah.
You know, when you link all these shootings to people watching video games, I was unaware of this. Apparently, there's really no link.
Yeah. There isn't at all.
In Japan, they spend a lot more percentage of income per capita on video games, and there's not the shootings. And among serial killers, they're not, or not serial killers, but mass shooters.
Yeah.
They're not into video games.
Because that's social.
Yeah.
And if you look at Japan too, like the way that rape features into all their popular culture, instances of rape are incredibly low. There's a shocking amount of just random rape in a lot of Japanese stuff. Like you're watching a spy movie and all of a sudden just there's like a huge rape scene for no reason.
But it's probably not the case. I'm trying to get to the end of The Villainous.
Yes. It's probably not the
case. Have you seen The Villainous?
No.
No, it's so
good. Is it good?
There's so much murder in it. It was so funny. The first scene of the movie is like a first person shooter game, which is this young girl who's, you know, of course, a super trained super killer.
Of course, yeah.
Goes into the mafia headquarters and just kills, you know, hundreds of people.
I do like that.
But it's all one shot. And I was watching it, and it was like Barbara and I were watching it together. And I was like, I don't know if she likes these super crazy, hilariously violent movies the way I do. We'll put it on. And she's like so intent on it.
Yeah.
And I went, you like this actually more than I thought you would. She goes, I'm looking for the cut because she's an editor.
Yeah.
So she immediately is watching it like an editor. Like, where is the cut?
Like Atomic Blonde. Do you see Atomic Blonde?
I haven't seen it yet. No.
There's an amazing, it's like a 10-minute take, no cuts, one camera fight scene on this stairwell.
Yeah.
And it's unbelievably good and horrifically violent.
No, I'll have to watch it.
But I think.
See, I enjoy the shit out of that stuff.
It's really good.
I've never killed anybody.
I haven't either.
Yeah.
That I know of. But the two highest grossing movies in Japanese history for a number of years were a film series called Raped by an Angel. Like they beat E.T.
Well, that's that was the original title of E.T. in Japan.
Yeah,
they added
absolutely.
One scene.
Yeah, they put wings on him.
Well, there was also Rape Man, which was a
rape
Japanese.
Man, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a real thing in Japan. Instead of hitmen, they hire rape men because it's a bigger disservice to you to have your wife raped than it is to just murder somebody.
Bits that I did that I couldn't do now.
Yeah.
The last bit on my last hour-long special, I couldn't do now.
I had a bit.
Not my album, not my last album, but the.
Just let me put my thoughts in.
The last bit on I Know What's Wrong.
Oh, okay.
I could not do now.
I mean, I could not do now. I used to have a bit about a real conversation I had in high school with my health teacher who would say that men couldn't be raped. And it was like a very weird, but she believed full on, like even if like a prison situation. Because like she was just like men are all they're up for whatever.
But, oh, I see.
Yeah, it was this weird thing, and I was like, and the bit was like, she's not totally wrong because like a lot of guys have trouble performing under the best of circumstances. Like, but she was always like, yeah, anytime they'll just go. And it was this longer bit, but I realized there was like a noticeable difference when you would do the bit, and then all of a sudden everyone would just be like, nope. Nope. Yeah, yeah. They laugh before.
You just get to the end. You get to the end of the rope on that. I used to do a bit. I don't know if I could do it now. I'm sure I couldn't. About how, like, the fear of men when they go to jail is that they don't want to be raped. Yeah. That was famously Jared Kushner's fear that he would go to jail and get raped. And
which
I was like, wondering, you know, to cut down on the prison population, you just have house arrest, and then once a day a guy comes by to rape you.
Yeah. They have a rape man. That's how it works in Japan.
Like the man from Glad. He comes in on that jetpack. Okay, let's get going.
Time to rape the prisoners.
Let's go. I got a big day.
It's just the Dunkin' Donuts guy. That's what he would look like.
The guy with a mustache.
With a mustache and an apron.
Yeah. I don't know if you could do that. I don't know. Worth a shot.
Yeah.
Well, now you go to Antarctica and I have seen footage of you in a helicopter that had a bear, a polar bear, and a net under it. So you're not an armchair quarterback here. You've gone out there. You've darted and sedated these animals. Is the polar bear plight because of the changing geography there? Is that the most urgent extinction issue that keeps you up at night?
Oh, there's so many. It's not just polar bears. The thing with the bears is that they're really a marine mammal. They spend 8 months out on the ice. The ice is forming later. When the ice forms, bam, they're gone. The ice forms overnight at Churchill, and then they're gone in the first few hours that the ice forms, and then they're out on the ice for the whole winter. But now the ice, which used to form Halloween, has been forming later, and it's melting earlier, so they lose killing time.
Them and me both. You go down to Antarctica to tag polar bears?
Penguins there.
Okay.
Polar bears only in the north, and penguins only in the south. And so the penguins, we wanted to see stomach contents with styrofoam and different plastics. In the Southern Ocean, remember, things come in and they don't go out. And so it just spins. So we end up with a lot of pollutants North and South America. And
it's basically the shower cookie of the world.
Right, right. And so styrofoam is so bad. It lasts in the ocean for 400 years before it will disintegrate. And so there are, in fact, my bees selectively want to pick it up to put in the walls of their hive in order to, because it's such a great insulator of keep the heat in.
Right.
But styrofoam is a problem. Plastics are a problem. And there's so many things that we could be doing.
When you were saying when you go ashore in Antarctica, they vacuum you?
What? Before on the boat, yeah, before you go ashore, because if there's seeds in your boots or grass or in your clothing or spores, these things will take off there now and start to grow. There's big areas of grass, and there never had been. And we know there hasn't been because we have ice cores 150,000 years.
Oh, I see. So you know there's been no grass there, and they don't want anything to grow there.
And now there's grass.
Right. It is. Well, it is. You have like there's in New England now. They're looking at their fourth nor'easter in 2 weeks, I think. And you used to get one every couple of years. And it's like, well, see, there's no, how can it be global warming if there's four snows? No, it's just change. This is happening because it's warmer where it should be colder.
That's right. If we just look at the last 10 years, the average temperature, it's been incredible.
Yeah, but one of the things that you get from rising temperatures is more snow, because there's more snow, there's more water in the atmosphere, and then as the temperatures go down, you get more snow. So it all ties together.
The melting in Antarctica is dramatic. You know, you see these giant bergs come off that are larger than Delaware was this one, and I mean the size of these ice shelves as they melt. So I think the big thing is the challenge of the next generation is to try and continue to improve the quality of life of people, but without wrecking the place.
Right, right. And there has to be some weird kind of balance.
Yeah, because in conservation, our successes are temporary, but our failures are permanent.
Same with love. Our successes are temporary, and our failures are permanent. That's how I look at it.
Well, that's right. You said, you know, we were given this wonderful thing that some of these people think that we weren't given. We borrowed it from future generations. You know, and if we wreck it, they'll go. And you know what? They were burning all this stuff and they knew it. And they,
yeah. Well, that's the other that's thing. That's the old quote about nuclear war. Like, you know, if they're wrong, there'll be nobody around to tell them. I saw a video of you. I think you were in Mongolia, rappelling down into a cave, and you found these rare kind of snakes.
Well, they told me in that area, they told me there were no snakes, and it looked like great snake country to me. So we found
this hole. So you naturally said, let me get up close and personal.
We found this hole, and I told the kids, you know, tie a rope around my waist, and it was about 45 feet down, and we went down, and there were 200 or 300 vipers sleeping in the bottom of it, but it was wintertime, so they were too cold to do anything. But yeah, we've been putting radio transmitters in the rattlesnakes here, so we put some in the vipers there to learn about their behavior. Now, there's so many animals we don't know anything about.
Do you put radio transmitters into snakes to see what kind of music they like? I don't know.
Put radio transmitters into
snakes love Nat King Cole.
Who doesn't?
No, who doesn't? You. Well, okay, so let me unpack this for a minute. You're lowered by a rope 45 feet down into a hole in the ground in Mongolia, and you notice that the floor is covered with vipers.
Sleeping.
And your first thought isn't, "Get me out of here!" Your first thought, "Hey, what do you know? How are you?" Do you just not have the natural revulsion towards snakes and vipers that a lot of people do?
Well, a respect for them. You know, uh-huh. I think that with these guys, we need to, here in Colorado, the rattlesnakes do a great job with prairie dogs. And where we kill too many snakes, the prairie dogs get plague. So we end up with bubonic plague here.
I didn't know that.
So they're good for the prairie dogs. It's good for the snakes. The snakes eat the dumb ones and sick ones, and so it's good for everybody. So I think even the most humble or inconspicuous or even revolting animal has a job. Even the most humble creature, there's some reason.
Let's just say it: the dung beetle. Let's just get it out.
I know that would be a bad job. But we need them. We need them. You know,
you ever wonder what the president's going to come back as in his next life? So when you radio mic a rattler, one, how do you do that? And then two, what do you learn?
Well, with the rattlesnakes here, we've done a job. We've done a study through the state, through the Denver Zoo, and some on our own, where we catch the snakes. And we mark them with a GPS where we catch them. We take them back to the veterinary hospital. And usually we do maybe 20 males and 20 females. And then we surgically implant a radio transmitter that we can find for, 400 or 500 yards away. And ideally, and then implant that in their abdomen and follow them for a year. And then at the end of the year, before the battery dies, we hook it around the last rib and have it in the abdomen. It's tiny. It's less than about 1% of their body weight. So it doesn't bother them. And then I take them out and let them be snakes again. But what we've learned here in Colorado is
let the snakes be snakes. Do you ever want to, while you have them under, like glue a little blonde wig and tattoo lipstick on them?
Welcome to Political Talk with two guys from Boston, a working man's look at the socio-political issues of our day. And now, Political Talk with two guys from Boston.
This is Political Talk with two guys from Boston. I'm Johnny Condon.
Robbie Sullivan here.
We're brought to you by Bevel Aqua Heating and Air Conditioning.
We're cool if you're cool.
And we still are.
Yeah, we are.
After all these years, we should come up with a slogan like Bevel Aqua Heating and Air Conditioning. 7 1/4 years.
It's almost 8. He gets a little ahead of himself. He wants to put out the ad before we're actually at. I think he said, let's do a 10-year anniversary ad. We were like, yeah, we got 7 in.
But or just something totally unrelated.
Fact check.
Bevilacqua Heating and Air Conditioning. You want a coffee?
I do think it's part of the reason we keep our customer base.
I think we do.
We put cinnamon in our coffee and they come running.
I think more products should just have general, just, it's so rare that you get good messages. There's so much shit in the world.
Bevilacqua Heating and Air Conditioning. Yeah. How's your feet?
Bevilacqua, Campbell Soup, don't be a cock.
Now that would work. I think that would work. If they had a vegetable, what's the one with the lettuce? Alphabet soup. Don't be a cock, and it just said it in the soup. Alphabet soup. Yeah. It just, they form. The letters sort of slip together.
Just positive messages for society. Dixie Riddle Cups. Leave him alone. He's queer.
I'm not sure how that works, but it works. That really does. That would have to be local. Sure that would go over well in the country, but we would understand here.
That was the tricky thing about, you know, you have to explain to people in the regular country when they come to buy, like, it's changing now a little bit because it's changing at gunpoint.
Yeah.
But like, queer, somebody was a queer, it was, they were just a jerk.
Yeah.
Don't be queer.
No, it's exactly.
And if somebody was a homosexual, they might have been queer, but then it was the fact, leave him alone, he's queer.
Yeah, right.
And just leave him alone.
He's dealing with enough on his
plate. Yeah, he's not bothering
he's
anybody.
He's one of the only people we know that come out.
He's got the softest hands in the neighborhood.
Would you give him a break already?
Jesus.
He's kind of cute.
He's get off
he's adorable. Would you leave him alone?
Get off his dick. He's queer.
I'm in love with him. Would you leave him alone? Oh, wait.
God. He looks like Bobby Orr. Leave him alone.
That's the kind of thing, too, with our family. They'd be like, oh, yeah, he's a wonderful man. It's too bad you heard about his kid, right? Cool. You'd be like, what? How is that a bad
thing?
What are you talking about? He's alive. He's well. He's good. It's like when someone says they're having a baby, and they go, I just want him healthy.
I just want him healthy.
I've never heard anyone say, as long as they're not queer.
All I care about is my kids grow up sexy. If they grow up... they grow up to be sexy, that's all I want.
You know, the word... queer, there's a time in history when it was to celebrate your differences with everyone, and
exactly.
It was to celebrate it. It was to show up and say, yeah, look what I'm going to wear, a tutu, and I'm a 350-pound man who works at the bank, but what a night I'm having.
This is my night.
This is my night. I call it public shame, but before Facebook, you know, you could do this stuff. No one's going to know except for your one friend who's got the picture. That's it. It doesn't go up.
People don't understand in Massachusetts. Really, they ridicule you. No, they ridicule you. You can be like, hey, I just got elected the Pope. Don't shit yourself. Hey, great. Don't shit yourself.
Yeah, what does that do for me?
Exactly.
That's the real thing.
What, you wear a dress now?
Yeah.
Don't shit yourself.
What are you kidding? Why do I care? So when do I come into this story is a real natural thing for me now. When I realize I'm like, if I'm 4 minutes into a story, whoever I'm talking to is now sighing. If it's not about them.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
my where group do I of come friends.
In? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
this is who I'm pitching stuff off of.
Somebody was talking to somebody last night, and they went to see Paul McCartney was touring.
Oh, yeah.
My friend calls him Paul McCarthy, just to annoy me. We went to see Paul McCarthy. It's McCartney. How many decades does he have to be famous before you get his fucking name right? The other one that drives me crazy, Rod. I was watching Twilight Zone marathon on Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah, I watched some of that too. Yeah. I was pissed.
Well, on Channel 38, and I'm watching it. My mother goes by, oh, is that Rod Sterling? No, it's not. It's Rod Serling. For God's sakes, he's been famous since 1950. Get his goddamn name right.
That's really funny.
Oh, that's John. That Paul McCarthy and John Lennon. They wrote songs.
No, is that real?
It might as well be.
Oh, that's so funny. Have you seen this program, Black Mirror?
Oh, yeah. Very depressing.
So, but it is like the Twilight Zone of 2018.
It's the Twilight, but I saw two. There's so one episode, guy fucked a pig. Another episode, guy fell in love with a woman and he had to watch her do porn. I'm like, I'm out.
It's harsh. It's harsh. Here's what happens in the middle of that. You're watching that show and you're 5 minutes in and you go, I'm not sure my constitution can handle this.
I don't know. What it is.
I can't do
this. This is British. It's going to be better. It's going to be better than anything over here.
I get scared. Like 5 minutes in, I'm such a pussy sometimes. I go, you know what? Should we watch another, you know, episode on Netflix of the people that the what's the Marinese or whatever the freak it was? It's like a documentary on the Sienese.
I can't watch any. There's too much TV.
I don't know. But it's
people
just,
come up to me like with television shows that I've never. Have you watched Wigwam Cemetery? No, I don't even know what that is.
I know people are posting about.
Have you seen Empire of the Butter Chicken? No. Oh my God, we're 40 episodes in. We can't stop.
But you remember, you'd come to my house Saturday mornings. There's three stations, and then there's 56, 38, maybe one other one, 60s.
27?
Yeah, the 27. That was another one. Where you're like,
38, 56, and one station.
You don't get to 27 until you already see that there's no more reruns on 56 and 38.
Channel 38 would have the Bruins. Channel 56.
Dana Hersey.
But the way it would be, you have a choice. Channel 38 would be showing the Bruins. Channel 56 would be showing Star Trek and Gilligan's Island.
Yeah, Gilligan's
and
Island.
Channel 27 had the Bowery Boys and Hee Haw.
Rifleman, which is in that show, one of my friends, every time anything with that guy comes up, because he played for the Celtics, believe it or not, the guy who played the Rifleman.
Chuck Connors. I was going to say Chuck Woolery.
You know,
he played for the Celtics?
He goes, you know that gun? They weren't even out yet.
He's like, as if like television made a massive error in having him have a gun that hadn't, there was no such thing as that gun in that period of time is what his point is. And he does it like, humanity, let that one slide. Like it was way more important to him than anyone.
A friend of mine went to some convention and Major West was there.
Oh, yeah.
From Lost in Space.
Of course.
And he was like, Dr. Smith ruined the show.
No.
Dr. Smith ruined the show.
He
was really
funny and I wasn't.
Well, I guess I don't remember the when Lost in Space started, it was very serious.
Oh, that's
it was
wonderful.
Very serious when it started, and then it became the official show of the Man Boy Love Association.
Oh, that's wonderful. I didn't know that.
Dr. Smith ruined the show. He's furious. He lives in Massachusetts.
Man Boy Love, explain this, because of Will and Dr. Smith? Yeah, the whole thing. I've never heard of that. Like NAMBLA coming to space? Is that what you're talking about?
If you watch it now, you're like, don't let him go off with him.
Oh, yeah, you can't let him. They're on a moon somewhere.
They're on the moon.
Dude, yeah. There's no protective services.
Yeah, there's you're Lost in Space. The Valua budget of Lost in Space had to be through the roof.
In the same way that
on Hee Haw, I imagine going to the wardrobe trailer on Hee Haw and it's just bib overalls, just racks and racks of bib overalls.
And imagine if you're like,
all XXL, XXXXXL.
Who's one of the big names on that one? Just imagine if you're allergic to hay and you get that job.
You're Buck Owens and you're allergic to hay.
You can't do it. You just keep going, can we get a synthetic hay?
Oh man, Hee Haw was my mother.
I loved
Hee Haw.
Any show that kept coming at you with maybe jokes, like jokes that might work for you, but they might not. And sometimes we're like, "Was that funny?" And I'm just not getting it.
There's weird things that you remember. And all I can remember is I'll be like in the car and I'll hear this. It's the music that they would play. When they would pop up in the cardboard coins. That was it. The cardboard coin music.
Isn't that when Artie Johnson?
That was Laughing.
Oh, yeah, Laughing. No, he peeks out behind the thing. I remember as a kid.
Laughing was Hee Haw for people who didn't have sex with their family. A lot of people will say that I'm stereotyping when I say that.
Yeah.
And they're right. Anyway.
Remember how many Clemens games we would go to because Clemens would pitch
and you'd
be like, you know, it's free. When we were kids, you could walk into Fenway after the fourth inning for free. Mm-hmm. So we'd walk in, watch that last few innings or whatever. And as you're coming out, you realize there are people that started drinking at 4 p.m.
Oh, yeah.
7 p.m. game.
Oh, yeah.
Now it's 10. And that's 6 hours of drinking. Now
that's a lot. Yeah, your liver is a bar rag.
And you have thousands of drunk people heading back into the streets that don't remember where their car is. And they're all looking around
angrily,
like, where were we? So some of that, you just watch them doing laps. They're figuring it out.
Angrily lurching the Fenway.
Exactly. And you know, Fenway's a great place, but as a kid, I remember thinking if we're a Yankees game, we're going to get into a fight.
Terror, they're angrily lurching the Fenway, terrorizing Northeastern students.
Coming from the flask and Kagan? No, the cast and flagon.
Yeah, yeah, cast and flagon. I had a girlfriend. I had a girlfriend that used to live in the Fenway. Never found what happened to her. She was a waitress that played against Sam's.
Amazing.
Laurie Jean Bellow.
Oh,
never knew what happened to her.
She's fine.
I hope she's fine.
I think she's fine.
I hope she's fine. 11 kids.
Her brother Nick is on my Facebook page. He's good.
Whatever happened to Laurie Jean Bellow?
Laurie Jean, how are you, dear? That's what you'd have to
say. Yeah, how are you, darling?
Long ago. It's that long ago.
Yeah. I see you got a hideous disfigurement.
Well, you know,
someone, just always cheerful. Oh, someone was in a fire. Look at your face.
Isn't this fun?
Look at what happened to you. You look like the last piece of pizza.
That's a New England trope or rhythm. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Isn't this something? Look at you. Everyone's all jolled up for church.
And that would, and you could do that in that. Oh, look at this. The world is ending today. Oh, my gosh.
You're right. It's an energy.
Big chunks of flaming rock are falling out of the sky. Oh, my Lord. This is exciting. No school for you.
Oh, my God.
There seems to be a prehistoric animal emerging from the lake.
My grandmother, who would bring me along on garage sales as a kid to get a better deal.
She brought
the sympathy of a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old. Like, this is my net. Could he buy this for $1?
Yeah. No,
I don't want it. It's for her.
Could he? He has cancer.
But she really would do this.
Excuse me. And I'm here with my nephew. He has cancer.
Isn't this fun?
How much for this broken, dirty, evil Knievel scramble van?
My grandmother truly... Her best days were when she knows she just ripped someone blind. That was her favorite moment. She was a businesswoman and she owned a lot of property, but her favorite thing was to go in and get that dresser for, you know, $15 that's worth $400.
Oh, yeah,
even if you don't need it. It was a high.
Oh yeah, I get that. That was always. I never had that illness. As they said, my dad would say, "I got who was the rich guy?" My dad would always the Rockefellers.
Oh yeah, that was the name.
I got something the Rockefellers never have enough. And then he would.
Oh, that should be a bumper sticker. And then on
he would, and then he would pass out, and then alternate snore fart. I got enough. Funny.
I remember my father would fall asleep with the clicker in his hand, and if you went to get it, he'd immediately wake up and say, "No, Tiger's putting." And you'd be like, "Dad, the golf's not even on." Like, I don't know what the Tiger's putting. What? No, that's not what's happening right now. But he loved Tiger Woods.
Well, my dad would say, "Why won't Hogan just escape?" He's in a Nazi camp, for God's sake.
That's fantastic. Now, what about your mother yelling at the? At cops.
Oh, my mother would yell at cops, and my mother would. My mother would watch. Is the famous story of my mother passed out in the chair. She's got a partial on the arm of the chair, so she's kind of breathing. My buddy Pete DeCoste told me this story. Pete DeCoste was with me. My mother passed out in the chair. She comes to, looks at the TV, and just goes, "Get him, Kojak." and then there's a long silence, and then just, "Get him, Kojak. Get him."
Political Talk with Two Guys from Boston.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. The hot dogs at our concession stand do rate an appreciative whistle.
Films have a way of reflecting the social climate in which they're made. The early films of the 1920s were full of giddy, escapist fare, reflecting the devil-may-care attitude of the era. At least before the stock market crash in 1929 and the ravages of depression that followed, In the 1930s and up through the beginning of World War II, films by and large concentrated on escapism, whether it was high society comedies, giving audiences a glimpse into a tuxedo-clad, champagne-sipping wonderland that would never be within their reach, bigger, more powerful stories that transported the viewer into a land of fantasy. King Kong, The Wizard of Oz. But nowhere is this trend more obvious than in science fiction and horror films. By using, shall we say, the expanded palette of the fantastic, filmmakers are able to explore the deepest realms of the imagination and make real the anxieties of the audience. Dracula, going as far back as the original novel, is really a thinly masked exploration of xenophobic anxiety in the face of the gradual collapse of the British Empire, and a deep-seated fear of the other. Dark, mysterious immigrants coming forth from the shadows with furrowed brows and heavy accents to literally drain the lifeblood from the new world. Gojira, the original Japanese version of Godzilla, which is mandatory viewing, is a veritable orgasm of post-traumatic stress as the people of Japan slowly came to grips with the after effects of having a couple atomic bombs lobbed onto their heads. America dealt with its own atomic age anxieties in a similar way, as the Cold War in the 1950s sent Americans off to school or work every day with the threat of imminent nuclear war, with everything from air raid sirens, duck and cover drills, and backyard concrete survival bunkers, all standard fare of the day. The movies transferred these existential fears into something a little easier to wrap one's head around. The anxieties of McCarthyism. The fact that your neighbor may not actually be your neighbor. The fact that even the kindly old lady living down the street might actually be a communist spy. These anxieties found their ways into films like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, It Came from Outer Space, and the underrated I Married a Monster from Outer Space. But that was the Cold War. There was also fear of a very hot war, a global thermonuclear war. And with that came the horrors of atomic testing and the havoc it would wreak on our environment. In 1954, the same year Japanese nuclear anxiety waded ashore in the form of Godzilla, in the United States, nuclear testing in the Nevada desert had the unfortunate side effect of them.
Because in one moment of history-making violence, nature, mad, rampant, wrought its most awesome creation. For born in that swirling inferno of radioactive dust were things so horrible, so terrifying, so hideous, there is no word to describe them.
Followed in 1955 by Tarantula, which is about nuclear testing creating a giant, wait for it, wait for it, yes, a tarantula. Clint Eastwood has about two lines in that movie as a scientist. 1957 saw the Black Scorpion, but a giant scorpion. That was the year The Beginning of the End came out. That was about giant grasshoppers. Also in 1957, The Deadly Mantis, starring TV's Peter Gunn himself, Craig Stevens, but you knew that. 1958's Monster from Green Hell was about giant wasp beetles. It was directed by Kenneth Crane, who would follow it up the next year with the much more interesting The Manster, which is set in Japan and is about a two-headed dude. But all these movies were about bugs that, because of exposure to radiation, became monsters. Each in their own way, a variation on the Frankenstein story. Humankind created a monster that turned around and made humankind pay. But in 1963, a different sort of monster movie emerged. In this case, the animals did it all on their own. Fed up with our poor stewardship of the environment, the animals took it upon themselves to send humanity a message.
How do you do? My name is Alfred Hitchcock, and I would like to tell you about my forthcoming lecture. It is about the birds and their age-long relationship with man.
They're coming! They're coming!
Loosely based on a 1952 story by Daphne du Maurier, The Birds is centered in the small town of Bodega Bay in Northern California, where thousands of birds begin periodically attacking the residents. There are plenty of scares in the movie, but much of the horror is psychological. It's more of a dread story than a suspense story. Hitchcock relied upon Sala and Remy Gassman, along with his musical alter ego, Bernard Herrmann, to create a soundtrack of synthesized electronic bird noises that does an amazing job of getting under your skin. But there was no nuclear testing in the movie, no terrors of the atom age. The Birds tells a much more subtle story. Humanity stopped taking care of nature, and nature struck back. It would take 9 or 10 more years for the genre to pick up steam. But growing environmental awareness, which arose in the late 60s and early 70s along with the counterculture, and also a spike in pollution, would lead to a 2-decade run of Nature Strikes Back films, one of which would become, in its day, the top-grossing film of all time. Despite a false start in 1963, the eco-horror genre got well underway in 1972.
Suppose nature gave a war and everybody came. The snakes, the birds, the lizards and frogs. And suppose that the polluters, the species on Earth called man, were the enemy in that war.
Frogs! Starring Sam Elliott and Ray Milland. There's not a lot of subtlety in Frogs. Ray Milland plays a wealthy dude who lives on a big plantation, and for a guy who appears to live in the center of the Everglades, he hates nature. So he keeps covering the grounds with all sorts of pesticides and what have you. So first the snakes, then the birds, then the lizards, and finally the frogs decide to take matters into their own hands. Ray Milland is killed, spoiler alert, at the end of the movie when the power goes out and hundreds of frogs break into his house and stare at him. And he dies. I'm not kidding. Frogs is great. The best part about it is the poster, which had a giant frog with a human hand hanging out of its mouth, even though there are no giant frogs in the movie. 1972 also saw Night of the Lepus, in which rabbits are injected with a growth hormone to make for better eating. But instead, they grow to the size of elephants and terrorize a small town. You could throw this into the giant bug category, but it's growth hormones instead of radiation. Plus, it has Dr. McCoy himself, DeForest Kelly, wondering how to kill those cute if deadly rabbits. Blast it, Jim! Then, in 1975, the eco-horror phrase took off with a film about a... Well, I'll let you guess.
There is a creature alive today who has survived millions of years of evolution without change, without passion, and without logic. It lives to kill. A mindless eating machine. It will attack and devour anything. It is as if God created the devil and gave him jaws.
You're gonna need a bigger boat.
Jaws became a global sensation, and deservedly so, but it, at its heart, is an eco-horror movie. The shark is big, but not because of radiation, and it's here to terrorize humanity for foolishly thinking it was in charge of the beach and the ocean. After Jaws, every single animal one could find became the subject of its own eco-horror spin-off. And the late 70s and early 80s were so full of these movies, you were going to need a bigger drive-in. Among my favorites, first, the Jaws ripoffs and sequels, which, if we went through those, would take all day. But in the following year, in 1976, we got Grizzly, about a grizzly bear. The tagline of that movie was, "The biggest Jaws on land," lest you wonder what the filmmakers were aiming to cash in on. In 1979, we got Prophecy, which was about a giant mutated bear, which basically looks like the bear from Grizzly with a pizza hanging off its forehead. In 1977, we got Orca, which was about a killer whale, and Tentacles, which was about a killer octopus. 1978 saw Piranha, which, despite its sharp teeth, has its tongue planted firmly in cheek. It was directed by Joe Dante, friend of the podcast, and written by John Sayles, of all people. In 1976, we got the excellent Squirm, about an infestation of earthworms. It sounds silly, but they're not so silly when they come out of the shower head. Burt I. Gordon, who for a time gave Roger Corman a run for his money, not that Roger Corman would ever part with it, gave us 1976's Food of the Gods, based on a lesser-known H.G. Wells story about a mysterious ooze that grows out of the ground, resulting in giant worms, wasps, rats, and yes, chickens! Food of the Gods, which had a great poster, is probably most noteworthy in that it starred Marjo Gortner, who is famous for being a former child evangelist. And check out the documentary about him called Marjo. That is actually a great movie. That's also an incredible snapshot of 1970s America, for better or worse. That was followed by Burt I. Gordon's Empire of the Ants, also by H.G. Wells, which starred TV evangelist Oral Roberts. No, I'm kidding. It starred Joan Collins. 1977's Day of the Animals tells the story of how depletion of the ozone layer causes all the animals to go berserk and attack a hiking party. It's pretty forgettable, save for the fact that it's one of the last roles Leslie Nielsen played straight before switching over to comedy. In 1978, Irwin Allen, producer of the all-star disaster films like The Poseidon Adventure and The Towering Inferno, tried his hands at eco-horror with The Swarm, an all-star romp about people fleeing killer bees. The Swarm starred Henry Fonda, Michael Caine, Catherine Ross from The Graduate, Olivia de Havilland, Richard Chamberlain, Lee Grant, Jose Ferrer, Patty Duke, Slim Pickens, Fred McMurray, and it bombed. By the late 70s, the trend in eco-horror had slacked off, and the success of Star Wars in 1977 sent all the fly-by-nighters scurrying off in another direction, resulting in movies like Star Crash, Galaxina, and the original version of Battlestar Galactica. By the 1980s, with the election of Ronald Reagan and a socio-cultural lurch towards conservatism, environmental awareness wasn't so cool anymore, and the growing threat of a mysterious new disease called AIDS resulted in horror movies more attuned to the terrors found in your own body. A new burst of vampire films dealt with anxiety about blood transference, and more than anything, David Cronenberg's remake of The Fly. Fun fact, produced by Mel Brooks. The Fly gave voice to a growing sense in moviegoers that the greatest horror of all lie not in animals, but inside your own body. Eco-horrors did continue, but the trend was over. Yet their message was never more clear than in this 1977 commercial for margarine.
It's not nice to fool Mother Nature.
Great story if it ends there, right? Well, it needn't for you. Let's say you've a hankering to catch up on some 70s-tastic eco-horror. And I'm going to assume you own Jaws in some format. But maybe you want to catch up on Them, Tarantula, The Birds, Frogs, or Night of the Lepus with DeForest Kelly. Or the mutant hybrid bear pizza from Prophecy. Why not toddle over to danagould.com and click on our Amazon banner? Then shop away. You get what you want, and for no extra charge, we get a couple of bucks to keep the lights on here. Or visit our store at comedyfilmnerds.com for Bevilacqua heating and air conditioning t-shirts, Dana Gouldauer t-shirts, and signed vinyl copies of my albums Funhouse, Let Me Put My Thoughts in You and I Know It's Wrong. Or download my new album, Mr. Funny Man, available on Kill Rock Stars Records, on iTunes, or wherever fine albums are downloaded. From me to you, with love for money.
They come from miles to enjoy our intermission.
I bet you know who that is. It's everyone's favorite 150-foot-tall radioactive reptile, Godzilla. Or Gojira, as he is known in his native Japan. Gojira being a combination of the Japanese words for gorilla and whale, which in America describes anyone on the show Duck Dynasty.
Yeah, I said it.
Now, in America, when you say Godzilla, it conjures images of a guy in a droopy rubber suit fighting another guy in a droopy rubber suit over a miniature model of Tokyo. But the original Japanese version of Godzilla is what we're talking about. Americans consider the original Godzilla to be 1954's Godzilla, King of the Monsters, starring of all people Raymond Burr as Steve Martin, a wild and crazy American reporter visiting Tokyo just in time to watch it destroyed. Although that movie contains footage from the original, it cannot compare. The original is called Gojira, and it has an all-Japanese cast in a gritty, black-and-white, downbeat, post-nuclear tragedy. The film has a lot more in common with On the Beach or Failsafe than it does with later movies like Godzilla vs. Megalon. In 1953, a Japanese film producer named Tomoyaki Tanaka was inspired by the Lucky Dragon No. 5 incident, in which a small Japanese tuna boat strayed too close to an American nuclear test in the Marshall Islands, giving its entire crew radiation poisoning. From there, he spun a tale of a long extinct creature resuscitated from its watery grave by nuclear testing. The theme of the film is nuclear anxiety, with the after effects of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki blasts soaking up every frame. People in the film are always comparing Godzilla's raids to the nuclear attack, and in one exceptionally creepy scene, a young woman huddles against the wall of her building with her young child. As Godzilla is heard approaching, she holds her close and says, "It's okay, dear. We'll see Daddy in heaven soon." Godzilla went on to become, of course, not only a hit, but a Japanese cultural icon, right up there with Americans' Batman or Mickey Mouse. In sequel after sequel, Godzilla went from being a dark vision of a nuclear nightmare to something of a superhero himself. In 1971's Godzilla vs. the Smog Monster, he fought pollution. But his cultural influence is undeniable, especially in Japan. In 1996, Sony forked over a ton of dough to make the first American-made Godzilla movie, directed by the Independence Day team of Dean Devlin and Roland Emmerich. The film starred Matthew Broderick and was queued up to be the big blockbuster of that summer. That honor, of course, went to Saving Private Ryan. Not too surprisingly, the Sony remake of Godzilla was as bad as the original Gojira was great. And while the average moviegoers were disappointed, Godzilla fans were outraged. In the June 1998 issue of G-Fan, the official Godzilla fan magazine, editor and publisher J.D. Lees voiced fans' anger. Beneath the banner headline, "Fraudzilla," Mr. Lee writes, "I want to mention one area where I feel the filmmakers went badly off track. The Godzilla designers and creators took great pains to present Godzilla as a real animal, and in this, they succeeded admirably. But in doing so, they betrayed a huge misunderstanding about monsters in general, and Godzilla in particular. Steven Spielberg made the point in Jurassic Park that the dinos were not monsters, but really just animals, and he was correct to do this, but Godzilla is not just an animal. He really is a monster. So he should not behave like an animal. He should behave like a monster. He should not run from the army, but attack it. He should not dodge around buildings, but plow through them. Real animals can't spew a radioactive ray from their mouths, but fantasy monsters can. By trying to ground their creature so firmly in realism, the folks at Sony destroyed the very essence of what makes Godzilla special. No one would ever consider Sony's Godzilla King of the Monsters. Now, if Mr. Devlin wants to start building a positive relationship with Godzilla fans, I welcome that. My goal, as always, is to positively promote Godzilla and the kaiju genre, keeping the spark of imagination glowing bright in all of our hearts. Together we've passed another milestone. Let's take heart in the public's new and increased Godzilla awareness and look forward to better things ahead.
This is Groucho Marx. Did you know, for example, that your chances of surviving an atom bomb attack are excellent? It's true. I'm convinced that these precautions are necessary right now. They're important to your family, yourself, and your community.
Make sure you get yours and enjoy it now.
My current social bugaboo is all of these people who, with that fan, that dystopian fandom, like it, I have in my home, I have a lot of supplies in my garage.
Okay.
I'm responsible for many children, my kids, my girlfriend's kids. I'm like, shit comes down.
You also have fires and earthquakes and things.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. There will be at some point a major earthquake and services will be disrupted.
Yeah.
For a period of 1 to 7 days.
Yeah. You need some food and
Yeah, and I have food and first aid kits and water, and because I don't want my kids or my girlfriend's kids like,
Uno,
hey, I need something to eat, and you didn't do your job.
Right.
Your job is to make sure I'm safe, so I take that responsibility.
I don't want
to
have a draw straw situation on which one you have to eat.
I take that responsibility very seriously, and I'm well. I've accounted for everyone well. There are people who believe in you also need a machine gun because there will be hordes of people like, no, I believe that if we have a service disruption in Los Angeles of over 7 days, you might want a weapon to protect your family. And the way that weapon would be put into play would be you might have to at night sit on your roof.
Yeah.
And if you see people approaching your house, you might want to fire a shot into the air and say, I hear there's a nice house down the street.
Yeah.
And that will be enough.
Yeah.
You're never going to get into a Rambo, John Rambo situation where you're mowing down 40 people.
Well, I think that's uniquely American in that like American exceptionalism thing where they're like, one man can change the world. I am an action hero in my own movie. And when I get into these arguments with people all the time, they're like, well, I'm just keeping my family safe. And every time I go, how many times have you used your weapon, not fire it, but just used it to defuse the situation or keep someone safe? Never.
Never.
It's always never.
Yeah. How many people have killed their wife in an argument?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or themselves. Or there's also the mentality of, and I've heard people say this almost verbatim, where they're like, oh, you got 7 days of food, Dana? I got none. You know why? I got a gun. I'm going to take it from you. Like they just have like a real attitude like that. And it's like, oh, so your problem is you're just an asshole.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like that's it.
And I live in civilization.
Yeah.
Where we have a contract.
There are people who are waiting for civilization to break down so that they can go nuts. Like, well,
and that's the thing. It's twofold. Like, and all of those people are super patriotic, and yet they can't wait to murder the troops.
They want falling down.
They throw away tyranny. Like, you know, and by the way, their definition of tyranny is somebody comes to take their guns away.
Or just take
they can
the,
do yeah. anything else. They can take away your right to free speech, your right to practice religion. Your they could take as long as they give you a gun. It's not tyranny.
Yeah,
because none of when they signed the Patriot Act into order without reading it, nobody was worried about that.
No,
because they said, "Yeah, keep the guns, we'll be fine."
Yeah,
but there are these people who, and there are, I would say, tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands.
Yeah,
who do believe one day. I'm going to save the world from tyranny, myself, me and my buddies, because America is going to go the way of Germany in the 30s, and we're going to take on
the Wolverines.
United States.
Yeah.
And me and Rick and Goober and Trigger are going to take on the combined forces of the United States Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines and keep. And it's just, it is a delusion.
Yeah.
It is a fantasy. And it's a dangerous fantasy.
Absolutely.
Because their ability, their need to live in that fantasy requires that they want all of these ridiculous weapons available commercially, which are then never used for that scenario, but often used to murder children who are in math class.
Yeah.
If I want to wear a Star Trek costume to jury duty, that's living in a very similar fantasy world.
Price of freedom.
But I don't hurt anybody.
No. It depends on what you have your phaser set on.
I don't require, my phaser's a toy.
I think what we're getting at is you and I have a lot of hobbies we feel very passionately about.
Yes.
That we love and enrich our lives. And if any one of them, someone was like, this murders kids, we would be like, take it.
Yeah.
You know what? Don't need it.
Yeah.
Fine. Take, you know what? You can erase Planet of the Apes from history.
Yeah. If it kills kids, I don't need it.
Yeah.
If it kills kids, I don't need it. Yeah.
And that's all it is. Cause they'll go, well, there's a lot of sports shooters. And I'm like, get a fucking basketball. There's a lot of sports.
Yeah.
Get it. How about you do archery? It's kind of similar.
How about rubber bullets?
Yeah.
How about you can have an AR-15 and you can have a mag. You can have 100 drum mag or whatever it is, but they're rubber.
Yeah.
So they will. You can go into a school and really bruise up a lot of kids.
Sure,
if you really wanna.
And you have to wear a T-shirt when you use it that says "Out of order, dick broke."
Yeah, but that's it. And people, no, yeah.
Can't have any.
I think it's in Israel where you have a much higher chance of somebody coming at you it's a much more politically volatile culture than ours. Yeah. You can own those weapons. They are kept at the range.
Yeah,
and you are allowed, I believe, 100 rounds a year.
Have you seen The Trigger Effect?
The
97 movie with Kyle MacLachlan.
Yeah.
Rewatch that. I always recommend this movie, especially now, because the premise of that movie is the power goes out inexplicably. And in 3 days, suburbia kind of goes to hell.
Right.
But it's very clever because I think it's either Dylan Mulrooney or Dermot Mulroney, whoever. He's like the sort of fuck up brother that Kyle MacLachlan has, and he introduces a gun to the situation for the very reason that we've discussed. He's that kind of guy. And that introduction is what makes everything go wrong. And it's very well written and very believable. Like, I feel like if all those people watch that movie, they'd be like, oh, maybe that won't work out that way.
Yeah.
And it's because it's an instant escalation. Like, and it's perfectly written. There's a scene where their baby has an ear infection. So he goes to the pharmacy to get the prescription. And like, they're like, the computer's down. I can't give you the prescription. The guy pulls a gun and then like, shit goes wrong. Right. And it's like, if the gun wasn't in that situation, it didn't help anything.
Right, scenario. Yeah.
And it added to the chaos. And it's such a clever, disturbing movie that I think is relevant.
The one irrefutable argument is people say, well, in Australia, it's this and this. They don't have the right to have a firearm in their constitution.
True.
And we do.
Yeah.
But our right to have a firearm has been perverted to the point that it does not mean anyone can own anything with a trigger. It's also in the way your First Amendment rights do not allow you to call up the president and threaten his life, spray paint cunt on a library.
Yeah.
Your First Amendment rights have a lot of limitations.
Yeah.
And it's going to take a full generation, I think, to pull this back into a realm of sanity. But there is, I think part of the issue is that if you had a friend that liked to go to a strip joint and he always would bring an engagement ring with him.
Right.
Because he never knew if he was going to have to propose to one of the strippers. If he was going to get a lap dance and they were going to fall in love in that lap dance and he wanted to propose right there and then and get her. You would think you're crazy.
Yeah.
But if that same friend had an AR-15, because one day Marines are coming, man, I'm going to keep us safe, you're also crazy. People just let that go.
Maybe that guy should carry an engagement ring for the soldiers.
Yeah, that's what I would do.
Be like, don't kill me, marry me.
And then they go, soldiers would never, ever fight the population.
Yeah.
I agree with you. You don't need anything.
I disagree, knowing a lot of people I grew up with who went to join the military.
No, I think that's bullshit, but that's their chess move.
Oh, absolutely. Because they have to respect the soldiers.
Yeah. Actually, they would never. Good. Then you don't need anything. Yeah. You're
fine. Maybe the black ones would.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what a lot of it boils down to is most of these people are so terrified of the other.
Yeah.
And so it's like they assume there's like.
And you and I are not saying like, you want to own a gun? Fine. Own a gun. I don't think that you need military grade weaponry.
No. And if you can't have it, fucking grow up and deal with it. You know what I mean? Like, you can't buy a tank.
Yeah. Well, that was there's two really gross things. On the anniversary of the Marjory Stoneman school shooting, the National Rifle Association tweeted a photo of an AR-15 on that day that said, I'll take care of my own guns. Thank you. One. Yeah. All right. You are trolling the parents of dead children.
Yeah.
That's all you're doing. You are trolling grieving parents. And two, you'll take care of your own guns? Apparently not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because people keep getting a hold of them that shouldn't.
It's not them, though. It's not the weapon, Dana.
No, it's just like,
it's mental health.
Then take care of the guns better. It's like, you know, look, a chimpanzee can't handle a flamethrower.
Well,
right. That's why we don't hand them out at the zoo. That's why we don't handle them.
Maybe we should.
By the way, I would go to that zoo.
I absolutely would go to that zoo.
Or I would hover over that zoo in a flameproof bubble.
Yeah.
And just watch a bunch of chimps with flamethrowers. That might be the greatest.
I'm surprised that's not a TV show in Japan right now.
That will be a TV show 10 minutes after this thing wraps.
Flame zoo? Have you seen
a zoo.
Flame zoo. There's a Japanese game show where you have to be in a haunted house and scare little Japanese children.
Oh, no.
And so it's the game show to see.
No.
It's these cute little school kids and they have people like try to scare them and they can't touch them, but they're just like, try to scare them. And it's a real, like, very popular game show.
How old are the kids?
Oh, little, like six. Like these little in school uniforms.
And they're screaming?
Yeah, yeah. Like you have to set up something really scary for these kids. And like, it's ridiculous.
I went to Universal Studios Halloween Haunt with my girlfriend and her sister, now my ex-wife and former sister-in-law. And my sister-in-law is really, really funny. And whenever somebody would jump out at us, she would just go, very effective.
Then
we would separate. We separated and I could hear her like in different parts of the maze. I just hear, very effective.
Is she Jack Klugman? This was murder.
What do you do? Yeah. Brian, do you know Brian Kiley?
Yeah.
Brian, he used to do a really, really funny impression of Jack Klugman. He goes, this is Jack Klugman in every episode of Quincy. What do you mean heart attack? We're talking murder here.
My uncle one time knocked a guy out at Hammond Castle's haunted house who jumped out and
wrong time.
The guy fell downstairs. Like the guy was hurt bad.
Did he just, he was just caught him at the wrong
time? Yeah, the guy was like, my uncle reflex. Just spun around and just clocked him and went flying on these stone steps.
Did he apologize?
No, we just left. I don't know. I always joked that the guy was dressed as a zombie and he's going to show up at an ER and not get the medical attention he needs. They're going to be like, he's been dead for weeks.
We once, me, Rob Cohen, and Ken Daly were in the Pierce College Haunted Corn Maze. The late, great, late lamented Pierce College Haunted Corn Maze, which was in its day, hands down, my favorite Halloween attraction here in Los Angeles. It was just homespun enough.
Yeah.
And it was corn maze, and you go in the corn maze, and people would jump out. You couldn't touch it, but they jump out, and they had, you know, whatever.
Like a strip club. Did you bring an engagement ring?
Rob had a thing of kettle corn with him, and this guy jumps up and goes, Rob goes, want some kettle corn? And the guy goes, oh, thanks.
I feel like he would do that to a real monster.
Yeah. But I love the guy didn't break character. No, thanks.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Those people take their acting very seriously.
Oh, man. That's so crazy.
I ate earlier.
Are you a vegetarian?
No. I've got this friend. is the most fascinating man in the world, Robert Bakker, Dr. Robert Bakker, who came up with the idea of the hot-blooded dinosaurs, you know. But Bakker came up with this theory about meat eating. So he has a theory that we're obligate meat eaters, that we need not only meat, but we do need some meat protein, which I don't know. We see these different diets that are so crazy. Well, anyway, so Bakker, I got in touch with him again, and he's here in Colorado, and the Utah Raptors are bigger than a Velociraptor. When Spielberg made Jurassic Park, he wanted something big and scary, and the Velociraptors are only about 3 feet tall. But then they found these guys in Utah that were like a giant version of the Velociraptor. And so they found a couple of them that had been killed by a landslide, and he called me, and we were looking at the bones, and he said, look at these bones. And so, I mean, they got diseases just like we did.
That is bizarre. So what is your next overseas journey? Where do you go next, and why?
Go back to Mongolia. I think we're looking at the vultures there. So transmitters for those guys. And
one of the things I wanted to ask you about before we wrap up is, you know, there was recently a lot of stuff in the news about this trophy hunting in Africa.
Right.
And you will hear from people that it's a positive, that it benefits the other animals. It benefits XYZ. Is any of that true? As I look at it, there's a typical Hollywood pinko lefty, whatever other thing you want to staple to me.
Well, the trophy hunting is a problem with the polar bears, certainly, because there's just not that many of them that we can afford, you know, killing 50 or 60 a year in these populations. In I can tell you, the bighorn sheep, the Argali are beautiful. It's almost a prehistoric bighorn sheep, 100 pounds bigger than ours here in this country, in California and in Colorado. And so they will give these, let these people come for $50,000 and shoot one. Now, it'd be great if the $50,000 was earmarked for conservation. Yeah.
Going it goes back to somebody's gold toilet.
Going back to, but that's right. And so the corruption has been so bad in terms of where that money goes that we can't trace it. And that's the problem. Is hunting bad? Not necessarily. If you look at Ducks Unlimited here in this country, with how much money the duck hunters have given back to preservation of
No, I wasn't talking about duck or deer. I understand the function that serves.
But the trophy hunting for somebody just to do it, you know, and say, yeah, you know, I shot a rhino, or I shot one, you know, I think. I think all animals should be shot, but with a camera.
Yeah. I don't understand the need. And
if the money was going back to protect the species, you know, or to do something positive or constructive, where you could show the benefit. But I think that most of these animals are in so much trouble, it all comes down to preservation of habitat. You know, if we look at what's happening to animals worldwide, why are they in trouble? You go by the acronym HIPPO. First is habitat destruction and fragmentation of habitat. Second is invasive species and species that get in where they shouldn't be, outcompete the normal species. Three, the P is pollution and so much, you know, styrofoam and plastics and the things we're doing. Then the second P is population and just people. And then the last one is over-harvesting, like we talked about with the long-line fishing. Right. So those are the problems. And so if we could do constructive things with the money for trophy hunting, but sadly, up until now, I think that most of the trophy hunting is siphoned off for other things, and oftentimes by corrupt officials.
I'd also say that the benefit that you get is mitigated. That there's a it would be even more of a benefit donating $10. Be even more helpful to the lion population of Africa, not blowing one's brains out and sending them $100.
That's right. That's right.
So many other, or call your dad or go to his grave and just get it over with. I'm not everybody, but I don't see how anybody looks at a lion or an elephant and goes, oh, I'd love to shoot that. I just don't understand. I don't understand, especially elephants, which are so, they're in
tell, you know, and yeah, I eat bacon, so I get it. Yeah, pigs are smart too. I get it. But I just, so I guess I'm a hypocrite in that regard. But goddamn.
Well, we all are. We all are.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, the problem with elephants particularly is, again, you know, habitat destruction and pushing them into smaller and smaller places. And so we need to maybe right now set aside some, you know, wilderness. You know, wilderness is you know, where nature is a place that it's not under the control of people. And it's mm-hmm. just left to its own devices. And so, you know, like E.O. Wilson came up with this idea of half Earth, half to be developed and half to be left alone and to preserve these things. And so, you know, we could do things like that. There's so many smart things we could be doing. And but there's enough of us. I think that I'm constantly encouraged because conservation used to be, you know, the tree huggers and old ladies. And now when you talk to people, and everybody wants the same thing. Nobody wants to read about, you know, the last polar bear died today. And also kids get it. When I go to schools, you know, I'm encouraged.
You just have to decide how much of that lunacy you're going to let into your life.
Yeah. I mean, like those open carry states, right? Which are a lot of southern states, which have a lot of big haunted attractions, or like a hell house, let's say.
Yeah.
Are you going to let some guy walk in with a gun on his hip into like a haunted house? Does that happen?
The situation as it is not working.
No.
I can't think of any other situation where the only solution is more of the thing that causes the problem.
Unless it's some weird sci-fi thing where they're like, we'll fight this cancer with cancer.
Yeah, that's it. But outside of that, I can't find, and they go like, college campuses would be better if people could walk around with guns. And the teachers are going like, I'm not going to fail a kid who's got a gun on him.
Be better for the kid.
Yeah. You know, I was like, hello. Well, then you have a gun.
What did you say? My meal plan's at zero? Yeah.
What if the kid has a gun and then you have a gun, but then the kid's gun can shoot down your bullets? Then you need anti-bullet bullets.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it gets to lunacy so quickly.
And I don't know.
And it must only be our culture.
Yeah. Well, like Australia, they're pretty tough, badass people in Australia.
Yeah. They're all, it's descended from a penal colony.
Yeah. Like everyone.
Mad Max is Australian, by the way.
They're like, pop my own dislocated shoulder in, no big deal.
Yeah.
They're tough guys.
Yeah.
They don't need guns. Like, they're like, it's no problem. It's not like they're weak in being constantly invaded.
No, or they don't need machine guns. Like, the Australian Prime Minister was on television, and he was like, no, I grew up on a farm in the outback.
Yeah,
my dad had a shotgun, and we use it occasionally. And if you told my dad he needed a machine gun, he'd say, I think you're a bit off, mate.
Yeah.
You know, it's ridiculous. Don't need a machine gun.
Yeah, there's no need for it.
Call your dad and work it out.
Yeah.
And
if he's dead, he died.
Yeah. If he's dead, get a Ouija board.
Yes.
Work it out with your dad.
Rent the movie Dad with Jackie Gleason and Tom Hanks. Just deal with it.
Is that movie as bad as it sounds?
It's real bad. I think it's Gleason's last movie too.
Yeah. Hanks made some real turd burgers there before he quit.
Yeah. What's the one with him and John Candy where they, the man, the Peace Corps?
I walked out of The Man with One Red Shoe.
I see. I like that movie.
Yeah,
because I like Jim Belushi. I'm the one.
Yeah,
but he's great. Did you ever see Real Men with him and John Ritter?
No.
Oh, it's great.
I love John Ritter.
Super bizarre.
God, I love John Ritter.
Jim Belushi plays like a super spy who has to recruit.
I'm going.
He recruits John Ritter as a patsy who's just like this snebbish suburban dad on this like very critical mission because the agent that was supposed to do it got murdered and he looks like John Ritter. So it's just like this silly, but it's just
a fun Jim Belushi is a super spy. Super I don't spy. Know why you kept talking.
He makes a nail gun machine gun out of parts from the garage.
Are there battery operated nail guns? Cause that could do some damage. Yeah. That can do some damage.
Yeah. Nail Gun Massacre. We've all seen that movie.
Is that where Meryl Streep played Margaret Thatcher?
Yes.
Nail Gun Massacre.
Yep. It was an odd part to have in the film, but it was important and historically accurate, which was the big thing.
Nail Gun.
You never seen Nail Gun Massacre?
No, but I would think like a nail gun is just as effective as
a gun.
I mean, if you want to protect your family, You only need rubber bullets. Rubber bullet will incapacitate you.
Machete? A hammer?
Yeah. But a rubber bullet will incapacitate you. Oh, yeah. And then they can deal with it. You don't need to shred someone's... You know, one of the reasons that the children from Marjorie Stoneman were so immediately vilified by the people with a very vested interest in having no common sense gun safety legislation whatsoever. I don't want to say the right or anything like that because it's not a right. No, left thing.
They're just mercenary.
Yeah, it's not. It's absolutely positively not a right left thing.
And it's a really very small amount of people.
It's a very small amount of people, and it's a subset of a subset.
They're just
of a,
really loud.
Yes, they're small and loud, and it's a subset of a subset of a subset. But because they gave these numbers a face,
yeah, you know,
it's like 17 kids. It's just the number 17. But no, like they gave it a face, and I would never want to do it. But if you saw what those bullets do to a human body, it's not what you think. It's not like a dainty hole. And
it's not cowboys and Indians in the 50s.
People are literally ripped apart.
Yeah. They're in some cases unidentifiable.
Yeah. They're ripped apart. There's no reason for that stuff to be sold over the, it's like the Vegas shooter guy that they found.
That no one really even mentions anymore.
Yeah. Well, they also, he was using these tracer bullets
that
were illegal that some guy was making in Florida.
Yeah.
I had nothing to do with it. Why the fuck are you making tracer bullets?
To kill people real good.
Yeah. It's like, there's no other, you know, it's like, yes, I make undetectable food poisons.
Yeah.
But I don't do it to kill people.
It's just fun.
I do it for people who want to prepare to have to kill a lot of people at an embassy.
It's my right to make anthrax. It's all natural.
Yeah. It's just like at a certain point, you just got to go.
Well, I've gotten in arguments with people where they're like, oh, what's your solution then? And then I'm like, very simple. You can't buy automatic weapons. There's no reason that a person needs that.
Yeah.
Limits on ammunition. Amount of ammunition you can purchase and types of ammunition. You can't buy armor piercing bullets. You can't buy tracer bullets. You can't buy any of that stuff.
Yeah.
You could have only state run facilities where you can purchase weapons. In New Hampshire, you can't buy alcohol unless you go to a state liquor store.
Yeah.
Have that. There, you want to get your gun? You could still buy it. You just need to have a fed. It's just only. So that would close gun shows. That would close private sales. Sorry.
And they go, those tyranny. Yes. It's the tyranny that you endure to get a cell phone contract
or to buy whiskey.
Yeah. I know. It's just like
you
yeah.
can't.
I want the hoops that I have to go through to have a swimming pool.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to dig a hole in my yard.
Yeah.
In my own damn yard.
Yeah. Oh, you think so? Yeah. No, it's just.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, it's a very small, loud amount of people that
well,
kick
yeah,
up.
It's people that make money. It's.
Well, yeah. The NRA has nothing to do with its membership.
No.
I don't know what and I come from a family of NRA members. I don't know what their NRA membership money goes to. I think it basically pays for the newsletter they get.
Yeah.
The NRA money comes from
Russia.
comes from Smith & Wesson, Glock, Remington. Manley Carcano, Remington.
Yeah.
So, yeah. We absolutely want teachers to be armed. But see if they would still want teachers to be armed if teachers are armed and you have to donate the weapons.
They're not paying for them. Yeah.
Let's see it. Let's see what that happens.
Eric Prince's private security force can't be paid to train them or anything like that. I was on Twitter and I wrote something about, I think it was after the Vegas shooting. I was like, the NRA is a fantastic organization for cowards, and instantly just got barraged with weirdly a bunch of UFC people, which actually maybe not that weird, but, or this one dude who was just like, oh yeah. Raising my hand. And it was some like UFC, like ex-Marine, blah, blah, blah. And he started listing off his credentials basically as a tough guy. And then I was like, wow, you've done all that and you're still so insecure that you need a gun. And then he went ballistic. And then I looked him
Interesting
up.
Choice of words.
Yes. And then, he is on that show Hunting Hitler, that like fake ass, ridiculous show. So I just remember I wrote, best of luck in your hunt for Hitler. And then nothing. Nothing. I was like, these are the people.
James Elroy said, who's like, no pansy. Like, and again, I'll say for the 50th time, like, I get people that want to own a gun. Yeah. I don't think you need to arm yourself with, I don't think
some
you need
people just like them.
You don't need an automatic weapon.
No.
You don't need something that belches out bullets. You don't need it. And if you want it, go to a therapist, because your want, your desire for your specific recreation is unfortunately without anything reflecting on you personally, it is resulting in the death of children and as a civilization, and as we have to stop that.
I'll put it this way. My uncle's been a jeweler for almost his whole life.
Yeah.
Jewelers can buy cyanide. I think it's cyanide because they use the clean jewelry. Right. It cleans jewelry really, really good.
Yeah.
But that you need a special license and to be a jeweler to purchase this.
Right.
If you're like, I just can't get my ring as clean as I'd like it to, I want some damn cyanide. Yeah. They're like, you can't have that. I'm sure you want it. It gets does a good job, but you can't have it. Only certain people can.
Well, I'm sure
there's no difference.
I'm sure, you know, a Stinger missile launcher is technically a gun.
Yeah.
You pull a trigger and there's a combustion and it propels a exploding bullet. It's just all by degree. But you can't go buy a Stinger missile launcher.
No. Yet.
Because of the government. The government.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Well, because no one can also make those in a commercial way to make a lot of money off them. I also think we should just sneak into these people's homes at night and replace all their guns with those pie guns from Bugsy Malone and then break in and watch them shoot them at you.
And then also they would immediately play Yakety Sax the minute you engaged it.
Yeah.
Oh, man. We did not intend to go down this road.
As a society or
as a podcast. As a podcast. I thought we were going to talk about the Night Gallery all day.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I'm sure there's probably an episode that's relevant here.
We have, all this godlike technology we have now, but we still have Stone Age emotions, you know.
we're the chimp with the flamethrower.
That's right, you know. And so I think if we just would see that allowing other animals to survive is a long-term investment for ourselves, you know.
Yeah.
And so the animals are talking to us, and are we listening? That's the problem.
Yeah, good. Good. It's tricky to sell a concept that requires a comma in the sentence, regrettably. Now, before we go, I wanted to ask you, does Keith Richards still call you for animal advice?
He used to call me about this little dog Dandelion that was owned by his manager, but anytime they come, I try and have supper. You know, I did the tour. I did several tours, and so, you know, they helped me with school, and they're great guys. I mean, they're wonderful people and characters, you know. And I bounced for Barry Fay here in Colorado, and he did the whole tour in 69 and 72, and then I went on and bounced for Bill Graham for years and years until I got out of school. And being a little boy on a Rolling Stones tour was like running away with the circus. I mean, it was incredible. And
you have this very, like, for people that have just listened to the podcast show, this very sort of genteel manner, but physically you're, what are you,
6'4",
and you weigh about
235.
Yeah, you would not lose a fight.
But it wasn't about being tough. It was about knowing how you can, you know, avoid the fight. You know, when I went to work for Jimmy Callahan, the head bouncer for the Rolling Stones, he goes, "This is not about bloody mouths. This is not about tough guys. This is how smart are you to avoid it." And I tell the guy, "Look, you could take me for sure, but you know they're going to put you in jail. They'll go get two more bouncers and a cop, and you'll have breakfast on the county. You know, sit down, stop lighting firecrackers, and you know, or do whatever they were doing. Yeah. You know, but the tours were fun. I mean,
breakfast on the county."
You know, it was great in those days because the music was and so I can't say anything about today's music because I'm not of that generation.
Right.
But their music is the same. They're as enthused, but there's something so good about live music where you're actually seeing the drummer sweat and then the bass is bouncing off your chest. When I went to work with The Who, I still think, you know, they just didn't come across on record as well as it was live. I mean, there was nothing like it, or seeing, you know, Parliament Funkadelic or Willie Nelson. I was so lucky. The Flying Burrito Brothers.
I didn't know that Willie Nelson was in Parliament Funkadelic. That's a strange.
No, but Willie was so nice and so funny. Willie loves jokes. You know.
Yes, I've heard he's very funny, and I heard he's very funny, and that he's always telling jokes. And
always
I heard a weird
jokes.
Rumor that it can't be true. This can't be true. I heard a weird rumor about Willie Nelson. Can't be true. He smoked pot once.
Well, it's like medicine to him, but yeah, no, but he'd go, Hey, Kevin, how come Hitler didn't drink tequila? It made him mean, you know, when those are that's the kind of Willie jokes.
I mean, that's hilarious. And is he still touring?
Still touring and still his books are incredible. His books are incredible.
What are his books?
The Tao of Willie and they're nice. There'll be one thing about his life, and then one thing about touring, and then one thing of just humor, you know. And
I would like to read that.
Oh man, I mean, there's so many great jokes, and I wish I had one of those books in close hand. I mean, just pages of jokes, you know, so many great ones. You know, like a skeleton walks into a bar and says, "Give me a beer and a mop." You know, and then nobody gets it. And then 10 hours later, they go, "Jesus, now I get it." You know, the beer just falls out of
it. I just got it. You know,
but Willie's kind.
Yeah. You know,
that's the thing. Like Willie, he would stand and he'd stand behind the curtain and just before he'd go out and he'd look at the audience and he'd go, "You know, Kevin, 99% of them aren't with the person that they thought they'd be with. And that's why my songs will always play on the jukebox."
You know? Wow.
So, I mean, he's just a good guy.
That's amazing. That's chilling. That is chilling. It's so true. And 99% of the people there aren't with the person they thought they'd be with. And that's why my songs will always play on the jukebox. God damn it.
Yeah.
Just
Willie's beautiful. Willie's beautiful, man. That cat's beautiful.
Or Frank Sinatra go, "Hey, Kevin, what? Punch that guy out." Same thing.
I mean, Frank Sinatra was all right.
Yeah.
We bounced for him, you know, or Elvis, you know what?
I just felt, you know, we talked in the last podcast about you and your brother bounced the last Elvis Presley tour in 1977, the tour that was never finished. And I was just on a Tumblr that was just this one Tumblr was people taking photos. It was just in the 70s, it was celebrities in the 70s. And people would just take photos of the camera and a lot of people would scan them. And they had a little December 69, December 70, those little date stamp that would be on Kodak photos. And there was one of just Mick and Keith backstage with Ike and Tina Turner. If you didn't know who it was, just four people in a shitty, ugly room in weird clothes talking in 1969. Because it's not lit professionally. It's just four people in a room, but it happens to be Mick, Keith, Ike, and Tina.
Well, and you know, there weren't cell phones. You know, we didn't have
the
pictures, you know, and imagine the trouble we would have been in now if there were cell phones, you know, when we were kids. But you know, there were opportunities with wonderful photographers for those tours, but it would be at a set time in a set room and they would go and have clothes. There wasn't the candid stuff that people do now. And you go to concerts now and everybody's holding their thing up. And, you know, it's like, man, enjoy the music. He's right in front of you.
I saw Paul McCartney on Hollywood Boulevard when he played for Jimmy Kimmel Live. And everybody in the audience had their back to the stage holding up their phone to get a photo of themselves with Paul McCartney in the background. And he's just going to go like, "No, it's not about you. Just watch the show. You're seeing Paul McCartney. Turn around and watch the show." But there was a photo in this Tumblr that I was looking at of Elvis Presley backstage 1977, towards the end, bloated, more bloated than fat. I mean, he looked just bloated from the drugs and the opioids. And it looks to me like you and your brother are walking right behind him. It was just like coming off stage, going back down to the dressing room. And it looked like you and your brother. And I emailed it to you. I go, "Is that you?" Like, "Looks like it."
Yeah, that was. But you know, I don't know.
Brother's bigger than you are, isn't he?
Yeah. The problem was with that tour was probably never should have happened, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, where they want to do it and that's all they know how to do. And it's part of their makeup, you know, and it's part of their, you know, it's like the old hunting dog that wants to get out there, but he's blind and deaf.
Yeah.
And,
well, this is,
you know, it's the fall and I got to get out there and after the birds. So I think, you know,
this was before interventions became a thing.
Well, he had so many people around him that should have helped him. I mean, it was sad. I mean, I think my brother said it best. He said, you know, and Warren Zevon said it too in a song where, you know, he lives in a world smaller than your hand. You know, yeah. He just, you know, the handlers would take him and feed him and take him here and take him there. And it was just, I mean, you know, I think with fame, I sometimes, you know, beware if you get what you ask for, you know, maybe you get more than you bargained for.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's that was what somebody said about the current president of the United States. It's like, yeah, he's the dog that caught the car. Like, now what? I don't know how to drive. Good luck. You're in a car. You're on the freeway. Have fun. Bill Murray famously said a lot of people want to be rich and famous. They should try just being rich. But that's the weird thing about our culture. I was listening to this thing today that one of the motivations of mass shooters is fame.
What a strange way to get away, strange avenue to get that, you know, to hurt somebody else. But
yeah, it's
you're just, okay.
We just went to this art show they had here in LA. It's the reason I live in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Because my friend's store is having an art exhibition with the original paintings from the Night Gallery.
Yeah.
That's why I'm going. That's why it's I live really in Los cool. Angeles.
Which is the best part of the Night Gallery.
Yes, yeah. But that's the thing. It's like the Night Gallery does not age well.
No.
It was not the Twilight Zone. The early 70s was also part of that hangover. Just like,
yeah,
just the clothes were horrible.
That's a big
hair
thing.
Was horrible.
And being interior color.
Design was horrible.
Yep. Attitudes were horrible.
Yeah.
But like the Twilight Zone, part of it, I mean, obviously it's very well written, very well acted, and it's
some
timeless.
Of it. A lot of it's
some
not.
Some of it's not. But because it's
it wasn't all Rod Serling.
It certainly isn't. Although Hugh Beaumont. Charles Beaumont. Beaumont.
Yeah.
Hugh Beaumont, the dad Hugh from Beaumont, Leave It to Beaver, wrote most of them.
Yeah. There are some really good ones.
Yeah, but because it's black and white, which weirdly doesn't make things look as old as people think.
Absolutely.
It does.
And
because you can't tell when it's set.
Right.
And because the style of the 50s
was much more universal than,
than
1971.
Suits haven't changed that much from then.
Yeah.
Whereas you got plaid bell bottoms and a shag do.
Yeah. It's the styles of like, I guess it was from 1968.
Yeah.
To
81.
80. Yeah. Maybe I was going to say 84 when the 80s really clicked in.
Yeah, 78 to 84 is what I dubbed the beige age.
Yeah, 78 to 84. Yeah, but it was just abhorrent.
Yeah, it's like somebody saw The Wicker Man and was like, just the wicker.
Just
the, I don't care about anything else. Make sure you're in the wicker.
Giant sideburns.
Yeah.
Huge lapels and bell bottoms and these bad Chief Brody glasses.
It doesn't help Serling that you can see his tan and his cigarette stains.
Yeah, he's so
in color.
Yeah. To quote Dennis Miller, Rod was the kind of guy that had to shave while shaving.
Yeah. Yeah. And it really comes across. So everything about it seems more low rent, even though that was probably a bigger budget show than the original Twilight Zone.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. It was big. Yeah. And there were some that were super, super scary. And I remember watching it. But yeah, the early 70s was its own era.
I love Pickman's model and the monster, and that's terrible.
Yes. There was a couple. They're tearing down Tim Riley's bar. Is good. Midnight Never Ends is pretty good. Although
cool,
Midnight Never Ends is kind of a Twilight Zone, right? Although I have to say, as somebody who has a TV show, you can recycle some stuff.
Yeah, of course.
That's a good. Show. We did this. Yeah. Good. Let's do it again.
Yeah. Worked once, didn't
worked
it?
Once, yeah. Change the show. Change the character.
Fool me once. Do it again.
Yeah, but it's whatever you grew up with, you love. And I talk to people that love these things that I don't think. It's like, oh, that wasn't that good.
Yeah.
But it's what you grew up with.
Is there a horror anthology show that you've, obviously not as good as The Twilight Zone, because I feel like there really isn't one, but that holds up in a similar way? Because you have, as much as you love The Twilight Zone, you have a very realistic view of it.
Yeah.
In that some of it was terrible.
Yeah.
Is there a show that you also feel is on par? There was a lot of horror anthologies.
Well, I think Alfred Hitchcock Presents, though, that suffers because it's an hour. The beautiful thing about the Twilight Zone was it was 22 minutes.
Yeah.
It's a good scary story is like a good funny story.
Yeah.
It's that it's a gag and you have to set up the gag and pay off the gag.
Right.
And it's the same. And I know as a working on Stand Against Evil, which is a horror show and a comedy, we have both, but it's like the gag is universal. What's the gag? either a, something's coming out of a grave to pull somebody right. down.
The prestige is just different.
Funny, or there's a funny thing that's going to happen. Everything else takes second place to whether or not the gag works. Character, motivations, all of those things have to take a back seat to getting the gag to work.
Right.
And a half hour lends itself to that. Your suspension of disbelief is just ebbing at 22 minutes.
Yeah.
You know?
It's almost too fast to see the seams.
Exactly. It just gets by. Are there, and then when you know, Twilight Zone was an hour in the season.
The last season, CBS season.
Fourth season.
Are there any good episodes from that season?
I think there's one on Tuesday we head for home. But by and large, it just doesn't work because it's bloated.
Yeah.
But like Boris Karloff's Thriller, Alfred Hitchcock presents.
Outer Limits was always an hour.
Outer Limits, pretty great.
You had monsters.
But again, because they're black and white and they have that look and they have that feel. Rick Overton used to talk about how great it would be to have been a character actor in LA in 1962. It's like, I'm doing a Twilight Zone, then I'm going to next week I'm doing Outer Limits, and I'm doing a Dr. Kildare.
My rosacea doesn't matter. Oh, yeah. I mean, those guys worked all the time and they got good money.
Yeah, they made a lot. Yeah, they made a lot of, money just every week.
Because people I know who in the 80s were on like Monsters and Tales from the Dark Side and Tales from the Crypt and all that stuff. It's not the same.
No. I think our line producer did Tales from the Crypt.
Tales from the Crypt was good, but again, it was using source material from the 50s.
Yeah.
My favorite episode of that is one with Bobcat and,
I think that was done.
Don Rickles.
That was directed by Barry.
Oh yeah,
Sonnenfeld, yes. Barry Josephson.
Yeah. I can't think of it now.
Yeah,
it's one of the Barrys. That's perfect.
Yeah,
that's a timeless one.
Yeah, like, Bob has really great stories about Rickles. That Rickles was constantly shitting on Bob in a playful way, and the minute they were alone, he was like, "Robert, are you smart with your money?"
Let me give you some advice.
He was so that was Don Rickles. Don Rickles was the anti Jerry Lewis.
Yeah,
Don asshole on stage, teddy bear off stage. Jerry Lewis, everybody loves him on stage. Off stage, total prick.
But he did a bunch of horror movies, like X-Men with X-Ray Eyes. He's heartbreaking and great in that role.
He's great. He's in the John Landis one about vampires.
Oh, Vampire in Brooklyn.
Nope.
Innocent Blood.
Innocent Blood.
Yeah.
He's in Innocent Blood. He plays a mobster.
He's
Landis,
great.
Landis and Rickles have been friends since the late 60s because Landis was a PA on Kelly's Heroes.
Okay, that makes sense.
That's how they made it. Landis made that great documentary about Don Rickles, Mr. Warm.
Yes, yes.
Which is a fantastic documentary.
Yeah.
But the thing about Bobcat that Rickles couldn't wrap his head around was that he wore jeans on stage. And he just
it's not showbiz.
What do you mean?
How do you sing your songs?
Well, we were talking about... Kevin Fitzgerald, who is also on this podcast, was talking about when he was bodyguard and like that George Burns would just be in his, he's the only bodyguard I know that covered George Burns and Keith Richards.
Of course.
Would be in his boxers until minutes before the stage call, and then he would put on his pants.
And you don't want to crease
his
him.
Pants were huge. His pants were huge.
It's a baggy pants comic.
Yeah, and he would go on stage. It was just this old show business thing. Like,
yeah,
I have a weird thing. Like, I have done it, but I rarely go on stage in like a hoodie and a t-shirt and stuff. Yeah. I don't think anybody does that now. But there was a time when it was ubiquitous. But I wouldn't feel it's like no, I'm working.
Yeah.
I'm working.
Yeah, you're at work. You're going to put on your...
But I know, like, in stand-up, I'm something of
an anomaly.
Yeah.
Are you an aberration?
No, I'm not an anomaly.
No, it's a little bit of a throwback, sort of. You come from a different...
Yeah, that's it. I'm of an exhibit.
Yeah. A businessman goes to work in a suit.
I've made the analogy before, and I was like, you know, I would be like if, you know, if John Doe came into your punk club, like, oh, well, we have to sit through this guy.
Because he was a Boogie Nights, were you.
He started it. Yeah, he is. He was good at Boogie Nights.
But, I mean, he dresses the same as he always did, which
is
hilarious.
Yeah, well, so do I. Yeah, you know, so do I. But it's like, yeah, no, I'm from a different era, but I'm not going to pretend to be from your era.
Yeah.
I'm just going to do it.
What's up, teenagers? Yeah, you're not dressing 20 something.
Listening to the new rap album?
Yes. This radio head.
Yeah. My draw when I go on the road is open micers that want to meet me before I'm dead.
Because they're going to kill you.
Yeah, eventually they'll kill me because I don't have a gun.
Which is basically the plot.
Because I just have canned peaches.
Yeah, which is basically the plot of that Tales from the Crypt with Bobcat. Oh,
what is the plot?
Don Rickles is a famous ventriloquist who is now who is now a recluse. And Bobcat is his biggest fan and has hunted him down and wants to like hear about the old days. And Rickles is just like, fuck off. I don't want to talk about it. And he has an injury to his ventriloquism hand.
Yeah.
Or you think he does. And the reveal, which won't ruin it because it's great, is that he's not actually a ventriloquist. His hand is his parasitic twin brother, who's an asshole. And who he keeps drugged up all the time.
Oh my God.
And he puts a little ventriloquist mask on his face, and that's why he was so good. And that's the reveal, and it goes south, but it's really good.
Oh my God. That's horrifying.
It's really good. And he's this little like, yeah, you always were an asshole. Like he's like just a little dick. And Rickles is tormented by this guy attached to his hand. It's probably the best episode of that show.
Wow.
But yeah, he's an open micer basically.
There was a really good Masters of Horror. I can't remember the title of it. There was a couple of those were really, really good.
Jennifer was great. I had Stephen Weber on my show. And
yeah,
Jennifer
wrote
the script for that
episode. Oh, did he write the script? Yeah, Steve's a very talented guy. I remember that the monster looked like the animated creatures in A Trip to the Moon.
Yeah.
It's just really, really brilliant. But I don't think there's anything, to use my old analogy, the Twilight Zone is the Beatles of anthology shows.
Yeah.
I don't think anything ever touched it. Black Mirror might have a level of consistency in terms of the quality of his storytelling, but I just found it's such a consistent downer.
Every
episode is just like one every three or four episodes is great.
Yeah.
You know, but it's just every episode is just so relentless. To me, it's just an acquired
taste. Did you see Dead Set?
No.
Dead Set's Charlie Brooker before he did Black Mirror. And it's a made for TV movie, zombies. But the premise is the people in the Big Brother house don't know the zombie apocalypse is happening.
Oh, okay. Right. I've heard about this.
Funny and horrifying, and it manages to capture Romero's flair for social commentary that even Romero lost.
Yeah.
And it's perfect.
Oh,
and I think it's the best thing he did, and the tone is perfect, and Black Mirror is too much of a downer.
Yeah, the Star Trek episode was fantastic.
Yeah.
But it's just like, forever, it's like, first episode, it's like, guys, fuck a pig.
Yeah.
The second episode, guy falls in love with a woman, then has to watch her do porn. I'm like, I'm out.
I saw Hardcore. George C. Scott really suffered.
Yeah, I have kids.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, I don't need this. I know the world is a horrible place.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you for reminding me.
You don't have to tell me the world's a horrible place. I'm protecting six people from it.
Yeah, that's the thing. I feel like we don't, to tie it together to the Trump stuff, we don't need the allegory anymore.
Yeah.
Like, it's right in our face slapping us.
It is interesting how horrible start to reflect that, because it will reflect that.
I don't know how, because it's so on the nose, you can't even.
I think the way to do it is the Friday the 13th. I'm in the movie now. I mean, that's really what it is. It's a TV show. He's hiring people from TV. I mean, he is brilliant in his unrelenting ability to spoon feed gruel to the lowest common denominator. He has no peer.
Yeah.
But I just don't know how many of those people there are, and when the other people are going to go, okay, that's it. Somebody said something like, when you talk about like this, I think it might have been you, like, all these people like, that's why we elected him. Okay, yeah, you fucked up said enough. All right, we're going to try to fix this now.
Yeah, and I think that the positive thing that I always think.
It was you, because you're the only person I've taught. You and Barbara. You and my kids are the only people I've just been trying to finish these scripts.
What an honor, thank you.
You're the only person I've been talking to.
I feel like younger people, aside from that alt-right nonsense, are not falling for that shit. And the people who are the base are dying. And part of the reason they're dying is the same reason that they're so easily fooled, is that they're put upon and they're poor and they're dumb. And they're not gonna survive. They're nervous about their own survival for a reason.
They're not gonna get the things he told them they were gonna get.
Nope.
And because those things don't exist.
Yeah. And they'll die off and then that's it. We'll have a new
Or they just get disenchanted. Okay, the tax cut went through. I don't know anybody who's making more money.
No. And I know people who are wealthy.
And they'll say, and they say that, and people buy it every time.
Like,
we'll give corporations money and they're going to invest, and they get, nope, they're going to keep it.
Yeah.
And screw you harder.
Absolutely. And not even in a fun way.
Yeah. It's true. It's true. But outside of that, everything's great. Let me ask you one last question, because you were talking today, you mentioned it today, and I didn't know you were on this. You were on
the Rolling Thunder tour, Bob Dylan's very famous 1975
75
tour. Right. Sam Shepard was on that tour, I believe.
Sam Shepard, a lot of people would come along for parts of it, you know.
Yeah, and that was unlike any. It was a very different, weird thing, and to me, it was sort of like the Rolling Thunder tour was sort of like the, and it's perfect that it happened in 1975 because it's a really like midpoint 70s. This, and then after that, let's try disco. What was the origin of that, and what was it like working for Bob Dylan in 1975?
I mean, the guy was a giant, and had all these people around him, and the thing was, there were so many great players on that thing, but people's roles weren't always so well defined, uh-huh. You know, that they could really shine. And what a talent! I mean, yeah. People can say what they want about Bob Dylan or make fun of him, but you know, that guy has an aura about him.
Yeah.
You know, and the same with Elvis. You know, I mean, he sucks the air out of a room when he's there.
Right.
You know, and you know, I mean, it must be hard for him. And I think that's, it happened to him as a young person, so it makes him wary of people. I mean, and their motives to be close to him. And that's the problem with fame, I think. You know, is this guy being nice to me to be nice to me? Or is this guy being nice to me
because
he wants something? Or and look what's happened with the press with these guys with different interviews, and people flavor it their own way or mm-hmm. shade it their way and make the guy come across as a jerk. You know, and he wasn't a jerk, and he was really anxious for all these players to come across and have their moment to shine. It was like being with the gypsies. You know?
Yeah, it really was just like I know because I'm a Dylan fan. Like that was also the tour. Is like I think I'm gonna wear white face. He would just paint his face white and go on stage.
It was bizarre, and then there was a Christianity part to it, and it was just you know there were Jews for Jesus around. It was you know bizarre.
Yeah,
and you know it was a different day, but one thing about him though is that, you know, he was pretty unselfish, and I always thought that was cool with these other musicians. And,
right.
You know, what can I do to, you know, and he had such a complex a thing, a mystique about him that you know with other bands you finally could kind of see or get a feel for somebody as a person, but with him I think, you know, it had such tough experiences with the press and with everything else that it, you know, very, you know, very secretive.
Yeah that was a tricky and weird time. What was your last tour before you quit
the Wu-Tang
altogether?
The Wu-Tang.
And what year was that?
2002.
I didn't know they went all the way up to the Wu-Tang Clan.
Yeah, they called me up and said, I hadn't bounced in years. And they called up and said, listen, we need a crew of people that know what they're doing. Because what had happened was
we Wu-Tang need a large white veterinarian.
Well, they needed some Irish people.
Uh-huh.
My brothers and cousins. And, you know, and so I just you know, the guy liked my voice, and so every night I got to go out and say, enter the Wu-Tang.
But that's amazing.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, enter the Wu-Tang.
I just imagine you're the Wu-Tang Clan fan, you're there, and then the first person that walks out on the stage is you.
Yeah, people are like, why is Gandalf here? Why is Wilford Brimley here?
Exactly. You know? Why is Gandalf here?
but they were great. I mean, they were great. It's a loose federation of rappers. And the problem was that we were trying to remedy for the promoter was they all had an entourage of people that was so large that it wasn't manageable backstage.
Yeah, it was like D-Day.
You know, and so we had to somehow do that and then teach their bouncers. We were training some guys. So, I'd had older guys show me the ropes and the business, and You know, I started in 69 and did it till I was out of vet school. The last thing I really did was the Victory Tour in 1985 for Michael Jackson. And then hit a pretty veterinary medicine pretty hard. And then came back and did some Stones things, you know, in 89 and 94. And then was pretty much done. I mean, it's not believable. You know, I'm 66. You know, the only time I don't have to pee is when I'm peeing. You know?
Other podcasts reach for the sky. Dana Goldbauer.
We barely try.
This has been the Dana Gould Hour, brought to you by the Internet. Music by Andy Paley, with Jake Posner behind the board. Produced by Jeff Fox. Graphic design and web production by Spencer Hunt and Segan Friend. Sound editing and post-production by Jalinda Palmer and Joe Napolitano. Hey, if you like the show, why don't you drop us a line at show@danagould.com. Tom Kenny speaking.
I'm a DJ, I'm a DJ, I'm a person, I'm a person, I'm a singer, I love to sing, and DJ, boom! Pizza, pizza, you want me? Pizza. Boom.